Good afternoon. I want to welcome you to the second meeting of the East Metro PSC Oversight Committee, which is a working group of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee in the House. We have quite a full agenda today and hopefully some interesting reports on some of the studies that have been underway this last many months. And so we're going to go ahead and get started. I'd like to ask the first set of presenters, Dean Johnson and John Stein, to come up to the desk. And while they are coming to the desk, I'll ask those seated at the table here, the representatives, starting down here on the end. Representative Guinness, you can move down if you'd like, Representative Guinness. Okay. To introduce themselves, starting on this end. I'd be Oakdale and Maplewood. Julie Bunn, House District 56A, runs from South Hill of Stillwater down to Woodbury and then along the river down to Lake St. Croix Beach.
Carla Bigham, 57A, which is Cottage Grove, South St. Paul, St. Paul Park, Newport, and Great Cloud Island Township.
Paul Gardner, representing 53A, Sherby, North Oakland, Lakes, Lexington, Circle Pines, and Blaine, chairing the Drinking Water Subcommittee, so I'm just sitting in. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And Director Stein, go ahead and start, or if Dean Johnson, if you're starting, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Stein. I'm the Director of Environmental Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. And the first item on the agenda is just an update on the biomonitoring project. And Dr. Gene Johnson from our Chronic Disease Division is here to present the status of that, and then we'll be able to answer any questions. I'm scanning the room, Madam Chair, for the staff that are not here yet, Dr. Gayden and Dr. Schubert, who are handle the next part of the agenda. So that's why my eyes are a little furtive. I apologize for that. I'm hoping they're going to come. I'm hoping they're going to arrive soon. We didn't get to connect before I left the office. So I'll have Dr. Johnson begin, and I'm going to just check on the availability of my staff. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm very pleased to be here today to give you just a brief update about progress on our proposal to conduct PSC biomonitoring pilot project. And this is being conducted through our new Environmental Health Tracking and Biomonitoring Program. As you know, the Environmental Health Tracking and Biomonitoring Program was created by the legislature during the 2007 session, and it requires MDH to create a biomonitoring pilot program to include four pilot projects to measure concentrations of chemicals of interest in participants' bodies. One of the pilot projects specified in the statute will collect and analyze biospecimens from 100 participants from each of two communities likely to be exposed to PFCs. At its first meeting in October, our scientific advisory panel made a recommendation that this pilot project be conducted in Washington County in areas where the drinking water has been found to be contaminated with PFCs. As currently proposed, the two communities that we've selected for the pilot projects are defined not by geographic boundaries, but by their drinking water source. The first community is comprised of all households served by the Oakdale Municipal Water Supply, and this includes not only Oakdale residents, but also a small number of households in Lake Elmo as well. There are approximately 27,000 people in Oakdale and approximately 9,000 city water connections. The second community that we've selected is comprised of households with private wells that are also known to be contaminated with PFOA or PFOS above trace levels. There are approximately 150 of these households which are located in parts of Lake Elmo and in Cottage Grove. All these private wells that meet this criteria are also contaminated with PFBA. Selection of these communities was based on known drinking water contamination, and the committee felt that this increases the likelihood that residences have been exposed in the past to two or more perfluorocarbons. To further increase the likelihood of detecting PFC exposure, we propose to limit eligibility to adults aged 20 years and over, and also to people who have lived in the household before January 1, 2005, which is the earliest date that contamination was discovered in the area. With carbon filtration systems and other interventions now in place, many, if not all, of these households that were affected are now currently not drinking the contaminated water, and this is why we felt it was important that we study, look at folks who were exposed prior to 2005. Mm-hmm. We expect the analysis of specimens, which in this case would be blood serum, would most likely detect past exposure to PFCs that have a long half-life in the body, a half-life of several years. We did not select communities where the only contaminant in the water supply was PFBA, and this is because PFBA, we know, has a very short half-life of several days in the body, so we would expect only to find current ongoing exposure to PFBA in a blood sample. Staff are now in the process of developing specific protocols for this project. We're looking at methods for selecting and inviting participants, methods for obtaining informed consent, collecting samples. And our advisory panel will be meeting again on Monday, coming up December 17th, and we'll be reviewing again the specifics of those protocols. We're also at the same time planning steps to ensure that the project is designed in a way that is acceptable to the communities. We're working to inform community members, local elected officials, and other stakeholders about the project and to solicit their input. Some of the methods that we are using and planning to use, letters to all the legislators in the district as well as some neighboring districts, those should go out next week. We are planning meetings with county and municipal officials. A press release to Metro News and community papers is planned. Possibly direct mailing to eligible households, community meetings, and we are planning outreach to physicians and medical facilities in the area. So we are open to any additional ideas at every stage that we'll be talking to stakeholders. If there are other ways that we can better inform and engage the community and solicit their input, we are open to that. So thank you.
Yes, Representative Wallace, go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Johnson, right? Mm-hmm. Thank you for being here today. I just have a series of questions I want to ask briefly. Is $2 million that was allocated for the four biomonitoring projects, right? Is that correct? And how much is allocated towards this specific one of the total amount? Are they evenly divided?
Madam Chair, I believe it was $1 million for the whole tracking and biomonitoring effort, of which I think $900,000 came to the health department, and that money was approximately split between tracking and biomonitoring. Mm-hmm. So the four projects have, I think, a little less than $500,000 each.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask a couple questions. I just wonder if that's really adequate to do this kind of a study, and when you think about what it involves in the geographical area, and then getting the word out, and then getting the participants, and all those types of things. So do you think it's adequate? Can you give your opinion on that?
Well, Madam Chair, we've planned so far two of the projects. We've planned the arsenic project and the PFC project, and we're looking now at what those two will cost and what will be left if we continue those two exactly as planned. And so our science panel is going to be looking at that question as well, mm-hmm. because the other two projects, which are mercury and a fourth chemical to be designated, it really depends on what we have left, what we'll be able to do with those.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, if I could also respond, Representative Wallach, we're working on a report on the biomonitoring pilot projects right now that is due to the legislature in January, where we will discuss the scope of these projects and the funding availability. At this point, the two projects that are designed, the arsenic biomonitoring project and the PFC, is actually two sub-projects within the PFC project. We do have the resources necessary to complete those projects, and there may be ways of accomplishing the other biomonitoring projects at lower cost using other sources of funds. We're exploring those opportunities right now, but we'll certainly have much more to say about that in our report that comes out on the pilot project work that we've been doing.
Mm-hmm. I want to make a couple clarifying comments. First of all, the dollar amount was incorrect. We were funded at $2 million over the biennium for the health tracking and biomonitoring combined. It was twice that. And also in that process, in terms of the fiscal note process with regards to the seven projects, when the fiscal note came back, it actually, when you read the detail, it actually only funded like two of the seven projects in the fiscal note. And then some conversation took place with the department at that time between myself and the department and also Senator Stephen, I believe, at the time. And partly what we heard back was, well, even if we, I said, why don't you actually, you know, ask for the funding for the entire request of the seven projects? And partly what I heard back, and maybe there's a more complicated explanation, was that these things take time to develop the capacity to do, to understand these processes. It's something new that the state's getting into. And, you know, we need a certain amount of time to gear up to do this. In any event, we're not sure we can spend more money than this effectively or get up to speed fast enough to do this many projects. And so they were seemed fairly satisfied at that time that the $2 million and starting with, and in fact, they're a little ahead of what I had expected, actually, by even doing the two projects, both TFCs and arsenic. At this juncture, I expected to see PSCs and the Arts Committee come along or the others later. So that was my sense. And Director Stein, you want to comment further on that?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. You're correct that the vast majority of the money that's being spent on the biomonitoring projects is for laboratory analysis. The community outreach and communications component of the biomonitoring projects is largely We did allocate funds for staff and some program resources as far as mailings and community meetings and so forth. But the staff that we put in place for both biomonitoring and pilot or the environmental health tracking work are basically going to facilitate the community outreach component of the biomonitoring pilot projects. And you're right, Representative Bunn, that we didn't fully have the ability to perceive what all the costs might be. Mm-hmm. At this point, I can tell you that we're expecting to be able to fully accomplish the arsenic biomonitoring pilot project and the PFC biomonitoring pilot project within the scope of the resources we have. We do have an opportunity to leverage some additional dollars, perhaps from other outside sources, to do a mercury project. We're still investigating that possibility. And then, as Dr. Johnson mentioned, we'll be back with the scientific advisory panel to talk about a fourth chemical. But that'll probably be later on in the spring of 08 when we're approaching that. So we'll really be into a second fiscal year's worth mm-hmm. of funding at that point in time. So I wouldn't want to say that I have a solid answer for you right now in terms of exactly lining out the numbers for the budget for biomonitoring.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one last question. When you're looking at this kind of a biomonitoring project and a blood serum sample, I have a question that, you know, comes from a total layperson's perspective, and a concern is it true that potentially that these chemicals could be harming pregnant women or their children, and are you going to specifically study that and take serum or samples mm-hmm. from women that are expecting? Mm-hmm. Have you thought about that? Because I worry that that's the population that potentially mm-hmm. can get hurt, or maybe not. Isn't there a study underway on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Swalwick, there is research that's been done at Johns Hopkins regarding the effects of PFCs in the pregnant mother's blood crossing over to the placenta, and there has been research on that subject. At this point, I would say it's not yet conclusive whether the effects are what level of risk to assign to that exposure, and that is a subject of ongoing research. So while I wouldn't want to say I agree or I disagree, I think it's too soon to know the answer to that question. It is important for us to move ahead with whatever biomonitoring data that we can collect so we can better understand the nature and extent of exposure of this community through the drinking water exposure. That's primary. As research is conducted and additional information comes forward, there may be another biomonitoring pilot project or another project that would be useful to look at. The concerns that you're raising about pregnant women. But at this point, I'd say it's too soon to tell.
Madam Chair, just the last follow-up. I hope we'll take a look at that at some point, if not as part of the study. I mean, it seems like it would make sense, and I know you have to do your studies a certain way and so forth, but it seems like it certainly would be helpful to monitor, you know, out of the 100 folks that you're going to do, and I don't know how you do that and get the right people and what stages they're at, but I just want to let you know, as a legislator, I'm concerned about that and hope you'll take that into consideration when you're designing the study.
Thank you. We'll take that back to our scientific advisory panel for their advice as well.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you. Dr. Stan, I would wholeheartedly agree with Representative Solik. I think that you, when you came out to the town hall meetings, that was one of the predominant questions that was asked at each one of those. So I would hope that we're able to accommodate the concerns of the individuals that were at the town hall meetings regarding this study. Mm-hmm. I guess I would hope that we can do that.
Thank you. To follow up on that one just briefly, with the decision to go with adults who have lived, had lived there prior to 2005 and adults only, based on the size of the sample you needed and the cost for doing 100 samples, that type of thing, and what all went into that final decision? And because we certainly during the development of legislation talked about this issue, and when we defined groups, you know, partly was to look at, you know, women, pregnant women, children, those subpopulations like that of various types. So if you could share a little insight into, you know, why at this stage, like, you know, you made this particular decision.
Certainly, Madam Chair, I can share a couple of the reasons. One I had mentioned previously, because we're looking at exposure that's accumulated over time. By looking at adults, we're more likely to see have had that time to accumulate that exposure. So that's one reason. But actually, there's another even more practical reason. A comparison that we want to be able to make is we want to be able to compare this to a national sample that's been done, and that's the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, or the NHANES sample. And they are divided up into age groups, so the numbers that we have from NHANES that we can use as comparison or reference values, there is a group that's age 20 and up, and that's why we selected that particular year, so that we have a comparable number that we can compare that to. So that was part of the decision also.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Johnson. Yeah. And Representative Whitney, yes?
Thank you. I want to follow up on this, too, because I think Representative Slavik and others have brought up a fundamental question. I mean, the most vulnerable are not 20 and over. The most vulnerable are fetuses and newborns. And it seems to me that besides the study you referenced, there is another study, and that's the Johns Hopkins study, that does have doses, and that we should be comparing to those doses, particularly since you were talking about long half-life.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could do some measuring of blood storage and have a wonderful comparison with the Johns Hopkins study. It just seems to me we're skating around the most important folks of all when we just design a study the way you're doing it. So I would add my voice to those of the others here, because I think you were missing a question and say, well, we'll put that off later. That doesn't make any sense when you're saying it's a long half-life. We're looking at folks to see what the half-life means to fetuses. I just don't understand why we put it off, particularly in this administration that has that concern about fetuses and young children. So that's the one thing. I mean, I just would agree with folks totally on that. The other thing is, there are other states that are doing some stuff here too. Are you talking to other states, like Massachusetts is working on the mercury issue? Are you pairing up with folks like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Genius, yes. Dr. Johnson should comment as well. But we are in contact with other states and with the Centers for Disease Control, who provide grants to about 20 other states for environmental health tracking and or biomonitoring project activities. Minnesota is not a recipient of those funds, and we do, I know that Dr. Johnson and the staff that are working on this have been in contact with them and do network with the other states that are involved. So in the design of the other pilot projects, that would be, yes, very relevant to consider what other possibilities are out there. One of the mercury biomonitoring pilot projects we are considering would involve collaboration with other states.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
Thank you.
Environmental Working Group has done probably some of the most visible of the monitoring of blood cores
Have you looked at their work, and would you comment on it?
Madam Chair, no, I have not seen their work, so I'm sorry, I can't comment on that.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be worthwhile to look mm-hmm. at it. They, I have heard their presentation. They brought up PFOAs, mm-hmm. well, PFCs, I guess. They brought up that issue. It's been all done on, these studies have all been done on blood crystal. So it seems to me we should be at least mm-hmm. knowing mm-hmm. what they said.
Yes, Madam Chair, we'll take a look at that.
And Dr. Johnson, did you want to comment on her previous comment?
And I'm sure, yes, I would just add, I guess, to what John said. He did mention that we have had contacts with other states, and I would just give a couple of examples. The two projects we've been working on are the urine arsenic and the PFCs, and we were recently, have been in touch with the state of New Mexico, for example, that's done extensive monitoring for arsenic in urine. So we've been talking with them about the methods that they've been using, and so we have been doing some of that. Mm-hmm. And on the PFCs, we've been trying to connect with the folks in West Virginia who are conducting the CH studies there mm-hmm. To see if we can coordinate with them as well.
Thank you. Oh,
if I could.
What's going on?
Have you contacted the folks at Johns Hopkins and mm-hmm. asked about some of their work and see how yours would work along with it?
Madam Chair and Representative Wagenius, our staff and Dr. Gayden, Helen Gayden, will be here on the next agenda item, and she has been looking at that information, the study that was done of newborns at Johns Hopkins, and so she does have a little bit more to say about that. So if we could return to that question at that time, that would be mm-hmm. Helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Any final comments or any final questions by the panelists or working group members? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And so we'll now have the second group from the Department of Health. Pam Schubert, Helen Gooden, and John Stein again.
I'll introduce Ms. Gayden, or Dr. Gayden again to this committee. And Dr. Gayden is our toxicologist who's responsible for the development of our health risk limits and our health-based values for the PFCs. And she is going to address some update on our health risk limits today. She's also going to be talking about the toxicological research that's going on these compounds. And then she's going to talk about some of the theories that have been evolving around relevant considerations looking at dose and internal doses and serum values in terms of our values and how that might affect things that we think about in the future, as well as giving you an update on PFBA, the compound for which we have not yet established a health-based value. So Dr. Gayden will give you that update.
Thank you. Yes, I'd like first to give you sort of an update on the health risk limits for PFOA and PFOS. Mm-hmm. As you are probably aware of, in August, we did promulgate PEARLS for PFOA and PFOS using the good cause exemption, the expedited process. Now, those rules are only in place for 2 years, and we are also in the process now of revising the PEARLS rule itself, and this will be a repeal and replacement actual process. So we are including PFOA and PFOS in the 2008 rule revisions that we're working on. Now, as John said, we're keeping abreast of the toxicity research on these chemicals, and that involves frequent contact with EPA researchers, researchers in academia, and also with 3M. I also frequently talk with environmental and risk assessment agencies at other states and also with EPA as well. In October, I was able to attend a couple of scientific meetings, one which I had helped organize a session on PFCs, and we were able to bring in several researchers from EPA's National Research Lab in North Carolina to present at that meeting. And based on the information we have available, we are not aware of any new studies that would alter our approach in terms of the studies we've selected and endpoints we've selected for PFOA and PFOS, and that's what we're going forward with too in the draft rule assessment. Now, one thing that has emerged is that there's a growing consensus that serum levels, which are a measure of internal dose, are much better predictors of the toxicity than administered dose. And as you may recall, administered dose is the standard approach that we use for the existing health risk limit for PFOA and PFOS. So what we are currently pursuing is actually using serum levels as the measurement that we will extrapolate from the dose-response relationship. That's the measure of dose that we prefer to use, and that's what we're pursuing in the draft values for the rule revision. And we hope that those values would be posted within the next 3 or 4 weeks on our website. Mm-hmm. And we also hope to use that approach for PFDA as well. Now, to update on the PFA activities, first I'd like to acknowledge that 3M has been very forthcoming and helpful with providing information and has been very cooperative with obtaining additional data analysis that we've requested from them. At the end of October, we received the draft final report for the 90-day main study. Mm-hmm. You recall last time I kind of separated main study versus ancillary studies. Mm-hmm. And we also received a report from them regarding estimations of half-life in humans for PFDA. Again, if you recall, half-life differences between species is a really critical piece of this puzzle that we need. And so that was extremely helpful. We quickly reviewed those studies, and like Gene had indicated, the half-life for PFDA is very short compared to PFOA and PFOS, several days versus several years for the other chemicals. The 90-day study results were consistent with the 28-day study results, so that meant we saw relatively mild effects on the liver and the thyroid. Now, this is good news because this means that even though there was longer exposure to these chemicals, it did not increase the toxicity.
Okay. Guys, that's just a point of clarification. Is this on rats or monkeys?
These studies were conducted on rats.
Okay, thank you.
And the studies also concluded that PFDA is less toxic than PFOA or PFOS. Mm-hmm. We also identified, based on those draft reports, some requests for additional information and additional data analysis from 3M. Part of the data that we requested was the ancillary studies that were conducted. We received those last week. Mm-hmm. And part of the data analysis that we requested was statistical analysis of selected effects from that 90-day and 28-day study and some modeling of dose to effect based on serum levels as well as administered doses. Mm-hmm. And those results we received yesterday. Mm-hmm. Now, including the submissions of these draft reports, 3M also presented a hypothesis regarding how the exposure to PFDA results in decreases in thyroid hormone levels, and also presented a case that these effects would not be relevant to humans. Mm-hmm. We are seriously weighing the weight of evidence for this hypothesis, and we've specifically solicited scientific opinion from scientists at the endocrinology branch at EPA's National Research Laboratory. I was able to actually connect with these people in October when I was out there for a scientific meeting. And the results of that consultation will certainly be taken into consideration when we select our endpoints of concern and calculate and derive our values. But that consultation is still ongoing at this point. And that's basically all I have for an update at this point.
Mm-hmm. Couple follow-ups. First thing I want to ask about in regards to the HRL update that you gave, in terms of the difference of taking it from the doses from the serum level versus the, I assume, administered type dose, what effects do you anticipate this change might have?
It should have a slight effect, not a huge effect.
In what direction?
I can't answer that question at this point.
Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just have a question. When you said there were no new studies, isn't there an EPA study underway that investigates the relation between the PFCs and pregnant mothers and low birth weight and so forth? Is that right in the middle of being studied, or has that been concluded?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of an EPA study evaluating pregnant women. There have been two publications, one by the John Hopkins group and one which evaluated a Danish cohort, mm-hmm. looking at cord levels or maternal blood levels and endpoints such as birth weight and head circumference, etc. But I'm not aware of an EPA study. I should clarify, my comments were to that even though there is ongoing research and there are new studies available, there are no new studies that indicate that our selection of the study and endpoints for the hurls for PFOA and PFOS need to be changed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, research continues to come in, but our selection of endpoints and our approach in that regard does not seem to need to be changed in terms of the new information that's coming out.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
I understood that the study was directly related to PFDAs and an EPA study, and I can talk to you about it, but it seems to be in a PowerPoint by the health department, so I can talk to you about where that information is and in the study and mm-hmm. and just get some verification. I don't have it with me. But is there a study related specifically to PFDAs in mobile birth weight?
Madam Chair, there is a developmental study in mice that was conducted by EPA researchers that we've been in contact with, and they presented the results of some of that at scientific meetings. They are currently working on a scientific publication that they hope to submit by the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. So that's underway.
Yes.
Okay.
Officer McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late. It's Dr. Gooden, isn't it?
Gayden, yes.
Dr. Gayden, sorry. Either Dr. Gayden or Mr. Stein, can you give us more information on what you're anticipating for a health-based value now that you've got more information? It's my understanding that most of the information has solidified some of the short-term information we were getting. So I'm just curious. We continue to be inundated by our constituents wondering, what is happening and what is the science showing.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I'll try to answer that so that Dr. Gayden doesn't have to. Discussion about a health-based value for PFDA is ongoing, and Dr. Gayden is our lead researcher and toxicologist that will be developing the scientific information that is used to establish that value. There is still ongoing scientific discourse over some of the theories and hypotheses of endpoints that system in the body that is relevant to choose in terms of looking for effects, as well as the nature of the chemical's effect on those systems. And so there's serious scientific debate, I might say, and you'll hear some of that a little later today, about questions that are asked. And so when asked, when do you conclude that you've had enough debate? That may be a good question for me to ask some of you. But I think it is important for us to consider the positions that other scientists hold. That's why we have asked 3M to give us additional data and research and analysis of statistical information, which they have done. And we have also engaged the US EPA's endocrinology researchers, as Dr. Gayden mentioned, in an attempt to get a non-Minnesota party to assist in evaluating those theories and ideas that are coming out in the scientific discussion. That being said, the question always rises, when will we think we're done with this discussion? I have said that we expect to have a health-based value sometime in February, and my staff has heard me say that. So now all of you have heard it said, and most everyone is probably going to write it down and embed it in their memory, that if I don't have the value done in February, I'll be accountable for that.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bingham?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Oh, sorry. Would you like to follow up? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Mr. Stein, let me ask you this. Do we have any reason to believe that... I actually have two questions. First, this one will be pretty simple. Is anything any different, and I'll ask 3M when they come up, I'm assuming they're going to come up, Madam Chair. Is there any reason for us to believe that any of the information you've been getting from them is anything less than accurate or anything less than forthright?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, no. There's the information and the research and the data that they receive, that they've been providing is scientifically credible. There's no reason to cast doubt on the integrity of their science. Some of the theories, some of the relevant hypotheses, and what the complete set of data and theories that will be considered in establishing values is what we're in discussion about. And that is an ongoing discussion between our scientists and 3M scientists, as well as others at the USEPA.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Stein, you wouldn't be doing your job if you were here telling me you agree with everything that they're saying in the interpretation. My second point is, the way I'm understanding what I'm hearing from the department and such, you anticipate that the health-based value will be increased. Is that a true statement for us to make an assumption? It seems like the information we're getting was not contrary to what we thought might come, and the anticipation was we were being conservative based on the science that was forthcoming. I understand you're going to give us, I'm asking for an inkling between now and February.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I'm not a very good card player, but I know not to ankle. I do know that. And so I am, your comment though is accurate, that what we've found as we've learned about the half-life of PFBA, as we've considered that data, as well as what Dr. Gayden said about the 28-day study results and the 90-day study results, there is lessening of the concern over PFBA and its effects. When we set the value for advisories, for well advisories, and for drinking water advisories, we used the number that we were applying at the time of one part per billion, and that was a number that was considered to be cautious and protective of public health. I'm not going to say whether we're in the neighborhood or far away from the neighborhood of what the number will be. That's why Dr. Gayden does her work, so that it's based on the science and not on my layperson's judgment of the direction. But it is true that there is a lessening of the concerns for toxicity over PFBA.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stein, kind of off of what Representative Beckman said, were these studies peer-reviewed?
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, of the data that we've been receiving, when they are published in scientific journals, yes, they are peer-reviewed. Dr. Gayden could say what the status of the studies are in terms of their publication.
Yes, Madam Chair. The manuscripts are under preparation and they're being reviewed by the authors, but I should point out that the results of the 28-day and 90-day studies were sent to the EPA scientists we were talking to. They wanted to, like, good scientists, they wanted to see the data and look at the methods, etc. So I guess indirectly there was a peer review. Specifically, we asked them to look at the thyroid information and etc. So in that sense, there has been some peer review of the data.
And have they sent a response or any sort of communication with you about their feedback?
Madam Chair, we've had several teleconferences which are still ongoing. And my impression is that they didn't have comments on the quality of the methods that were utilized. They did have one comment on one assay in terms of the level of variability that was seen. But that is not necessarily a reflection on that something, you know, negative happened. It's the animals had a larger variability for that particular endpoint. But so far, that's been the extent of the comments on in terms of the data quality.
I just have like a two-part question. Are there any other studies that are going to be continued short of the biomonitoring or separate from the biomonitoring? And we had a 20-day stay in 90. Is there any other studies going on? And I guess the second half of that is, are there, it's kind of been a recurring theme, but with these studies, are there any plans besides the biomonitoring to do a specific study on species, whether it be rats or monkeys that are pregnant?
Madam Chair, there is a developmental study that was conducted by EPA that will be published. That is the only developmental study that I'm aware of. I'm not aware of any other studies on PFBA that are being planned at this point. One of the outcomes of our evaluation may be to recommend specific additional studies to answer specific questions. That is a possibility.
And Madam Chair and Representative Bigham, if I could add to that, again, the Department of Health is not a research organization and an institute. The staff that works on these contaminant levels and risk assessment is a small group of people. It's four or five scientists in our agency, along with our public health laboratory staff who are also lend their credibility and their advice. But it's a very, we rely upon academics and other government agencies as well as the industry's research experts to inform our scientific evaluation of the risks associated with chemical exposure. So I want to be clear that we will recommend what we think some good ideas are mm-hmm. for ongoing research activities. Mm-hmm. However, that's not the business that the State of Minnesota Department of Health is in.
Another follow-up.
So, Dr. Stein, what you're saying is you can't make somebody do a study like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, that's correct. What we can do is we can advise on what the prudent scientific research activities would be to answer questions relative to risk of exposure.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Gayden, before we go to a few other questions here over on the right, I wanted you to follow up a little bit in a little bit more detail about three things. One is to summarize for the group again today, to the extent we did see some effects in the 28-day, 90-day, and this will lead into our next later presentation, is as small as those might have been, what were those effects? Number two, you mentioned the two further requests, the ancillary results that you said you received last week, and then the statistical analyses that requested that you received just yesterday. I'd like you to very briefly summarize what the purpose of the ancillary studies, what question they were geared to ask, to address, what you learned from that, if you can report it now, and then also what the additional statistical analysis was supposed to achieve.
Madam Chair, the specific effects that were observed in the 90-day and 28-day study were mild effects on the liver and thyroid. Those included decreases in cholesterol levels, increases in liver weight, decreases in circulating T4 thyroid hormone levels. Those would seem to be among the most sensitive endpoints. Mm-hmm. And those were seen in the 28-day study and were observed again in the 90-day study, mm-hmm. but not at necessarily lower levels than previously. Mm-hmm. The additional information that was requested that was gathered in the ancillary studies in particular were serum hormone analysis and also serum levels of PFBA itself in the test animals. That was information that wasn't included in the main study that was gathered by additional studies. Those are examples.
Mm-hmm.
The additional analysis, statistical analysis we requested, for example, is what's called benchmark dose modeling. It's a modeling procedure to relate measurement of dose, and we asked for two different types of measurements. One was administered dose in milligrams per kilogram for body weight of the animal, and the other was based on the serum level that was measured in the animal relative to the effects that were observed. For example, the serum level relative to the level of cholesterol that was observed in that animal. So those types of statistical analysis were requested so that we could better compare the results of the two studies.
Is it on this point?
Yeah.
Okay. Professor Bingham has a question on this point.
So I was a liberal arts major. So sciences, serums, and what's it? So what you're trying to get at is you want to make sure that each of the species that you're testing is having the same amount of serum for each of these tests? Were you afraid that something happened in the 28-day study that didn't happen in the 90, or they weren't at the same weights or the same serums? Or
Madam Chair, one of the main reasons for conducting the 90-day study in addition to the 28-day study is that often when an individual animal, et cetera, is exposed for a longer period of time, one may see effects showing up at lower dose levels. We wanted to make sure that that was not the case with this mm-hmm. with this chemical.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. And typically in the absence of longer-term studies, because of that uncertainty, we may apply an uncertainty factor when we derive our reference dose. So in order to get the information, the actual data, 3M conducted a 90-day study, a longer study. In terms of the serum measurements, the science is indicating that, you know, different species eliminate it differently. Repeat dosing an animal may alter the way it eliminates the chemical. So measurements of administered dose don't seem to predict as well the effects as measuring the actual internal dose, which is what the serum concentration measures.
Okay. And that has nothing to do with, say, somebody who consistently was exposed to something and then getting rid of it out of their body. Are you saying that somebody that has been continuously exposed to something for a longer period of time may not easily get rid of?
Madam Chair, the information that's available in animals is suggesting possibly that with repeated doses, it may actually induce or increase to some level the excretion. It depends on the dose. At really high level, I mean, again, it depends on the dose and the duration of the exposure, which again is one of the reasons why the actual measurement of the serum levels is a better measurement than what's being administered, because you have a much clearer picture of what's actually inside the body.
So this is why you asked that question.
Yes.
Correct. Now I got it. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Okay.
Representative Wiginius, and then Senator Folsom after that. Yeah.
Thank you. I want to follow up on Representative Bingham's question about peer review. And it's not peer review. You've been talking a lot to EPA. In recent years, EPA has become very politicized, and so that's not very comforting to me. So I'd like to know if you have asked anybody else other than 3M, like University of Minnesota or Johns Hopkins, to look at your basic 28-day and 90-day studies, to look at the basic structure, to see if those studies will tell us everything we need to know. And are they enough? And the reason I ask that is because I'm thinking one of the things that we often miss is what happens to the next generation, what happens to the offspring. And I can't tell, it doesn't seem to me from your study you can see what happens to the offspring from your study. So I guess I have two questions. Have you addressed that specifically? And have you had peer review from folks that would be totally without question in their objectivity, say Johns Hopkins or the U?
Madam Chair, the developmental study that was conducted by EPA has not been yet published, but it did indicate that developmental endpoints do not appear to be the most sensitive endpoints. The liver and the thyroid do appear to be more sensitive to the effects of PFDA. Than the developmental endpoints.
Mm-hmm.
We have not provided copies of the 28 or 90-day study to researchers at Johns Hopkins. The only individuals that we've provided this to were specific research scientists at EPA, and we asked their expert opinion. They are not officially representing EPA. Their opinions were provided simply as scientific experts, so they did not have to go through, you know, clearance. This must not represent, their opinion does not represent EPA policy. So there really, it should be no political leanings one way or the other on that. It was simply as experts in the area of endocrinology research. These are basic researchers. And I think what...
Madam Chair, if I could just, I wanted to help you with one thing, Dr. Gayden. If you could say, are there other researchers that you are aware of or that have been suggested to you by others that we should or could consult with to get outside opinion? I mean, I think that's the nature of Representative Wiginius' question. Are there others that could have a view of this that we haven't not consulted with?
That is my question. Are there, and it's just to look at, does the 28-day and 90-day study capture everything we need to know? And you talked about developmental. That wasn't the question I asked. It was reproductive.
Mm-hmm.
How is, can we tell from these studies if there is going to be an impact on the next generation? Mm-hmm. Because those are the studies that folks are doing now on a lot of things that are endocrine disruptors, and the thyroid is an endocrine system.
Dr. Gayden?
Madam Chair, certainly more research can be done, and we can solicit opinion from additional researchers. There have been several, certainly thyroid experts that have been suggested. One is Dr. Zoller from the Massachusetts University. We haven't, at this point, solicited his input. We could. One downside from doing that is it will delay development of a number. I mean, that is one of the consequences of seeking additional consultation, but we could do that. And in terms of whether we have all the information that we would want or need, no, we don't. But that is rarely ever the case in developing these numbers. So again, we could request additional studies and have those conducted.
Mm-hmm.
In the absence of information, what we do is apply uncertainty values that decrease the number to try to adjust those data gaps when they exist. We are also depending on the larger body of data from the PFCs in general in terms of identifying what really the sensitive endpoints are based on how these chemicals act in the body.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a follow-up over here to this point before we go to Salston.
I'll go after Salston.
Oh, okay. Fine. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. And on the same point, we must be having the same sort of karma over here. First of all, I deeply appreciate all the work you're doing on this. You are certainly being stretched on this, and I certainly appreciate that. But on the same point regarding how you are approaching this, and that the EPA, you just mentioned the fact that they are scientific experts, basic research, but not specialists, and that you could consult specialists, and along the same line of, are there people here in the state at the U of M that could be involved in advising you? Because I also heard Dr. Stein say that perhaps that you are not research-oriented, but how might we use resources here in the state to sort of make sure that we're asking the right questions, interpreting the data correctly? Seems like we're referring that like we are working with the EPA a lot, and that could be a good thing or perhaps not such a good thing. So I guess I just like to encourage you to look at some of these other folks, because when I hear the word could, but we're not, and there's a downside with a delay, I'd rather have this done right than rush it and then, I guess, look back later on and not have asked critical questions. I'm not sure that's a question or a comment, but a little bit of both.
Well, let me actually follow up on that and put it actually as a real question. I mean, in terms of this issue of you're being given the names of a thyroid expert or experts that you could, seek their opinion on this. My sense is that may have been, suggested to you some weeks ago, and, you have sent the 90-day and 20-day results to the EPA. I mean, it seems to me, I agree with Senator Salston that I think many of us would like to see this done as well as possible with the information that's out there. And if there are other experts in the country, particularly specializing on certain features of this in terms of the differential impacts of animals or humans or other kinds of issues that pertain to those particular endpoints that you're talking about, I would certainly hope that the state would seek that out. So if you could comment for us as to, it seems like, that wouldn't create a tremendous amount of delay. I don't know the process, but why? If EPA could give a feedback by now, why somebody else couldn't give feedback by now?
Madam Chair, we can certainly contact Dr. Zoller. I do want to clarify that the researchers that we contacted at EPA are specialists and experts in the area of endocrinology, including the thyroid. So they are expert in this area. And they also consulted with some of their colleagues as well, some of whom are doing research in the area of reproduction development, the immune system as well on the PFCs.
Mm-hmm.
So we can certainly pursue soliciting additional input on reviewing of the studies, mm-hmm. if that's necessary, yes.
Madam Chair, I also want to be respectful of the communities, because I know the communities are mm-hmm. urgently awaiting some information. And so while there's every good reason to get as much scientific advice as is available, there's also a need to respond to the communities and to continue to do our work in some other areas of needed research and health-based value establishment. So mm-hmm. while I appreciate the concern and the need to consult as much as possible, there comes a point at which we do need to establish a value, and we will obviously consult with you as we move through that process.
Mm-hmm. Representative Falls.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Gayden. I want to request that when we get the results of the EPA study on the mice and developmental delays, that we can get a copy of that whenever that's published, because we won't be aware of that. And along those lines and along the concern lines here in terms of what really is happening and how we're establishing the health-based values, I have a question for you, Mr. Stein, and the responsibilities of the Department of Health. When we are with our constituents and they are not sure what is in their drinking water, it causes some anxiety, as Representative McNamara explained, and as we all know when we're out there. Does the Department of Health ever consider, or as this is going on and we continue to have this debate, supplying bottled water either for the entire area or for women who are pregnant? Again, we get back to that issue because we aren't sure what the effects are and health-based values. So was that considered about doing that?
Madam Chair and Representative Slavik, the department, when we considered our drinking water advice for PFBA in particular, I think I'll limit the scope of my answer to that question because we did respond quickly and dealing with PFOA and PFOS, and the advice on those compounds was provided to the MPCA, and they are the ones who are responsible for alternative drinking water sources associated with contaminated sites, landfill sites, Superfund sites. So when we get to PFBA, we did consider whether or not there was a substantially defensible amount of data upon which to conclude that there was a risk that would warrant intervening with alternate drinking water supplies. And at the time we considered that risk, there was not a sufficient amount of data to make a decision and to issue a health-based value, so there was really no basis upon which to give advice to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to provide bottled water or alternative drinking water sources to any population or any subpopulation. So that was the motive for the department to establish its advice at a cautious level, giving the community the information, knowing what we as much as we could know, but there was a great deal of uncertainty about the risks associated with PFBA. So that was the decision we made in the fall of 2006 to issue that drinking water advice. And we did consider subpopulations. We did ask whether or not there was any reason to believe that there was a higher level of risk or a greater level of concern based on the data that was available. And because there was so limited data available at that time, we couldn't conclude that there was a reason to select any subpopulation or any group greater or less than any other group. So we simply gave the drinking water advice that we gave, which was to, if exposed to levels greater than one part per billion, consider reducing your exposure through alternate drinking water sources and or activated carbon filtration at the point of use filters or in home water filtering systems.
Mm-hmm. Representative Wiggins.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I sit on the LCCMR, Minnesota Citizens and Legislators in the Environment. And we do grants, and there were 5 scientific grants that are proposed for funding in this year's cycle. And each of those proposals are peer-reviewed in public. It happened yesterday. Scientists from around the state are gracious about helping us out by coming in and peer-reviewing, doing it in public. I think it costs us $55 a day. This is nothing. That's why I say they're so gracious to do it. Isn't that might be a helpful model for you to have local University of Minnesota scientists do a public review with you of the data? And I think that would give comfort to citizens that everything that needs to be done is being done.
And Chair, Representative Lucas, we'll take that under advice and talk about how we can. We do engage a number of groups in dialogue as we're working on health-based values, whether to make it more public and more open and accessible to others. I will take that under advice, and I'll discuss it with the staff and see what we can come up with.
On the question of public and accessible, when and where and how are the 28-day, 90-day ancillary statistical studies made public?
Well, typically, Madam Chair, when they're published, we do have electronic copies of those mm-hmm. reports. I guess we could confer with 3M if there are any issues that mm-hmm. publishing those things. There are hundreds of pages, mm-hmm. but they can be posted to our website if there are no other mm-hmm. objections.
Okay, so there's no in this type of situation in the past, you know, like public release, any formal process for public release that's been established by MDH in the past in these circumstances, other than you reporting to us in these kinds of forms.
I'm sure usually we typically rely on public information. This is a somewhat unique situation where we've got the actual basic information before it's ever been published.
Typically, there's a considerable delay before it's actually published. So that's why it's interesting. And Representative McNamara, do you have another question?
Dr. Gayden, I just wanted to confirm. I asked the question about the 3M and their scientists, and I want to confirm that the EPA scientists that you've dealt with have been forthright, and their opinions have been consistent. Has there been any reason for you to be alarmed at what they've had to say to you? Should we? I'm not disagreeing with Representative Wagenius that reaching outside is not a good idea. I actually like that. I think that's good. But I want to make sure that you've reached out to EPA because they've got some scientists there with expertise for the exact situation we're dealing with. And have they been forthright with you and consistent in their answers? Has there been any reason why we should think that you should be for sure going somewhere else to get other opinions from other people other than what you have done with the EPA? And then I guess I would like to just a side note to that. We do have concern. This world has gotten much more political than it used to be, unfortunately, and it even does scare some of us when we get into dealing with scientists. Has there been any reason for you to believe that politics have entered in what some of the EPA scientists have brought forth to you?
Madam Chair, I believe the opinions that were rendered by the EPA scientists in general actually reinforced our impression of what was in the literature, not necessarily specifically on PSDA, but on the endpoints that we were looking at. And so their opinions were very consistent with what we had seen in the published literature, and I thought they were very forthright, and I did not have any feeling whatsoever that there was any political implications whatsoever. I mean, that they were very, very clear to point out that we were soliciting strictly scientific professional opinions from them, and the fact that they worked at EPA was somewhat beside the point. They were not there to represent EPA. They were there to represent their scientific expertise and their experience in reviewing the information that we sent out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Representative Bigham.
Dr. Stein, I was just in kind of the whole, I was going to follow up on Representative Swalwick's comment on the bottled water. The decision not to do the bottled water for the PFBA for the results that were rendered in the fall of 06 was different than the bottled water decision you made with PFBA in the earlier spring. Am I not right?
There were situations in Lake Elmo where bottled water was issued where PFBA was the contaminant, and as data became started to become available, we started to back away from that decision. And so, yes, mm-hmm. there were bottled water decisions and recommendations given for a handful, or I shouldn't say a handful, but about a dozen wells in Lake Elmo.
But it was for the same level of
yes.
contaminants, the same
yes,
threshold
correct.
Of one part per billion in Lake Elmo, where there was bottled water, and then one part per billion and greater in the other in St. Paul Park, Newport area, and Cottage Grove.
Yes,
and there
correct.
Was no bottled water
There were about a dozen wells in Lake Elmo that had levels of PFBA without PFOA or PFOS. We did advise a number of well advisories in Lake Elmo that had a mixture of chemicals. The groundwater in Lake Elmo, generally speaking, had a number of contaminants. There were some few wells, as I said, that had PFBA that had no other compounds, and that I think the number is 12 or 16.
The discussion we have at every meeting.
We do have that every meeting, Representative Bigaman. Thank you for reminding me.
You're welcome.
Okay. Any other questions and comments on this line of this portion? Thank you very much, and we're going to move on to MPCA at this time. An update on consent agreement. And Director Stein, while they're doing that, we did have these three questions that had been submitted to agencies, one of which pertained to the water filter study and low doses. Depending on how the time goes in the next 10 minutes with this, I might still ask you that briefly at the end of their presentation. Okay? And while they're still setting up, just for those in the audience, originally we had, there was a possibility today that we'd be talking about the results from the first phase of the water filter study. I believe the results actually may have just arrived today. Someone waved, is that yes? And so they need a little more time to look at those, but the first phase results of the water filter study should be in today or very shortly. And so certainly by our next meeting, we will have those to discuss before us from the Department of Health. And go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Kathy Schaefer. I'm the remediation division director at the Pollution Control Agency, and we negotiated a consent order and agreement with 3M that was executed by our MPCA Citizens Board on May 22nd, mm-hmm. 2007, and what I'm going to do today is provide an update. We had provided an update a few months mm-hmm. ago as far as kind of where we've been since we entered into the agreement. What I'm going to do today is kind of pick up from that point and provide an update since then. So when I refer to quarter, it's kind of a quarterly time frame, and this actually is in line as we're required to report back to our Citizens Board on a quarterly basis mm-hmm. as far as what the status of the agreement is in our activities. So what I'm doing here today is kind of in line with that and a report that 3M is required to submit to us mm-hmm. on the work they're doing. So if you hear me say quarter, that's what I'm mm-hmm. referring to. Mm-hmm. But overall, the cooperation between the Pollution Control Agency and 3M on this process has been great. We've been complying with all the deadlines that we've complied with. As part of our review process, we've obviously had additional information that we've requested, where 3M has had to request additional time, but we're still on track for moving things forward and hopefully being able to initiate some type of response action beginning next year. What I'm going to go over today is a quick update on kind of where we're at with the three disposal sites, Oakdale, Lake Elmo, Woodbury, Oakdale, Cottage Grove, and Woodbury. Also going to talk a little bit about Washington County Landfill, the information sharing process, and then the health and toxicological studies that were part of the agreement. For the 3M Oakdale disposal site, the remedial investigation report and feasibility work plan was formally approved by the Pollution Control Agency on July 31st. As part of that approval, the Pollution Control Agency had requested some additional work be done of 3M, and that work has been completed. And it included additional field activities at the site, which was a geophysical survey, additional soil and groundwater sampling, and a groundwater recovery well evaluation. In addition, Pollution Control Agency is conducting an assessment of impacts to Raleigh Creek and Eagle Point Lake. Mm-hmm. And also 3M is in the process of installing a security fence on the north side of Highway 5, where higher PFC soil concentrations were found. As part of the process for all three of these sites, 3M is holding informational meetings each of the affected communities to talk about the options that they're considering and get public comment prior to their submittal of their feasibility study report. After submittal of the feasibility study report, the Pollution Control Agency will also then hold another public participation meeting so that the public again has another opportunity to provide comment, and that will be considered in the final approval of the remedial action plan that is the responsibility of the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. Mm-hmm. So what I'm going to do for each of these sites is just kind of give you a time frame of where we're at with that process.
Mm-hmm.
For Oakdale, the public information meeting was held last week on December 5th. The feasibility study report is due January 28th of 2008, and we're anticipating them having the public meeting, a 30-day comment period, and approval then with response actions hopefully being able to start in the spring or summer of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
For Cottage Grove, the remedial investigation and feasibility study work plan was approved on August 15th. Additional field activities that have occurred since then include geophysical survey and soil borings, groundwater recovery, well evaluation, and biological assessment of the East Cove. The public information meeting for Cottage Grove has been scheduled for January 31st, and the feasibility study report is due March 13th of 2008, and we anticipate doing response actions beginning in the summer of 2008. So you're going to see that the timelines for all these are pretty much in sync for next spring and activity occurring next summer. 3M Woodbury disposal sites. The investigation and feasibility study work plan was approved on August 17th. Additional work was required, and those activities have been completed. That included an updated survey topographic map of the site, investigation of other disposal areas on the site for PSCs, and a burial well evaluation plan. We have received the burial well evaluation report, and it's currently under review. In addition, the Pollution Control Agency, along with the Minnesota Department of Health, has sampled 1,007 residential wells within South Washington County. To date, 28 well advisories have been issued by the Department of Health that exceed the HRL for PFOA or PFOS or have additivity of the PFCs. The PFCA is providing bottled water to all those homes and is in the process of installing granulated activated carbon units to those homes. We currently have access agreements that have been signed by homeowners for 20 of those residences, and 13 have been installed to date. For Woodbury, the public information meeting is scheduled for January 10th, and the feasibility study is due February 18th, and again, we're expecting initiation of response actions in spring, summer 2008. The Washington County landfill is not part of the consent order as far as being a responsibility of 3M because it's in the closed landfill program, which is a state responsibility. But the consent order did provide funding of up to $8 million for that site, which is something that 3M was not obligated to do. Because it's included in the consent order for funding, and also because it is an East Metro site that's impacted by PFCs, I'm also going to provide an update on where we're at with that today also. That is similar in timeline with where we're at with the rest of the sites. PCA hired a contractor to evaluate the various alternatives that were being considered because we wanted the process to be similar to what's happening for the Superfund sites as far as having an independent contractor reviewing the alternatives, and so that we have a plan that's consistent. We just received a report from the consultant that evaluated the six alternatives. Mm-hmm. We met with the City of Lake Elmo last week to go through that process, and we have a communication plan in place that includes having a neighborhood informational meeting probably the first week of January, holding a workshop with the Lake Elmo City Council in early January, and then holding a formal public meeting that would encompass the entire community probably towards the end of January, which is similar to what we're doing at the other sites as far as holding public participation meetings and allowing 30 days for comments so that they can provide comment on what it is that we're looking at. In the meantime, we are still continuing to provide bottled water or the GAC units to those homes that currently are not hooked up to the municipal system. And I think at this point in time, we have three residences on bottled water and 52 that are on the GAC systems of the original 114.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Olson.
I have a question, if you might. I was at the site yesterday with the Senate bonding tour and sort of learned a little bit about the funding for this site, which I was not aware of, which is not a good thing or a bad thing. But I wonder if you could just briefly explain how the bonding bill is important to this project. Because that was something that I was not aware of, that it would be important that the bonding committee be aware. Is that accurate, that we need the support of the bonding committee to make this landfill site and its cleanup happen?
Mm-hmm.
Please.
Go ahead. Madam Chair. Yes, you're correct. Basically what we're looking at is the alternative that is recommended by the report, and again, we are looking at public comments. There's, we're going to need to do some additional work as far as evaluation of these alternatives. But what they're looking at is the alternative of where they would dig up the existing landfill mm-hmm. on site and then create a lined area on that existing site and move the garbage onto that. The price tag of that we're looking at is probably about a $23 million project. Under the consent order, up to $8 billion of that will be provided by 3M, which would leave of the remaining $15 million that would be needed for in the bonding cycle, and that has been included in our proposal mm-hmm. to the governor.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that, Madam Chair, because that was sort of new to me, that for those of us who are following the bonding committee activity, that's an important activity. But again, mm-hmm. what was clear to the bonding committee yesterday is that 3M did contribute up to the $8 million voluntarily, and that was noted with the bonding committee mm-hmm. yesterday.
Director Souther, could you comment on what's required in terms of notice for the three public meetings that you referred to? Well, you referred to other public meetings in Lake Elmo, the three with the Oakdale, Cottage Grove, and Woodbury sites. What is required or what is done in terms of public notice and by whom?
Madam Chair, for the 3M information meetings, mm-hmm. for the ones at CPA?
No, the 3M ones, the ones that are cited, the three dates that you cited.
Madam Chair, the informational meetings were the responsibility for 3M to hold and...
I will ask them.
And notice... And I know that they did have a plan in place, and they would be the best to answer that.
I asked the question partly because there's some Oakdale residents in the audience who I spoke to before the meeting and wished they had heard in advance of the meeting, but they didn't learn until after the fact and missed the meeting. And so I wanted to hear a little more clarification on that. And then while we have you up there, we also had a question submitted by a resident of the area about, in terms of the options for cleanup, are in-situ options being considered? And I would assume that in the aquifer itself, keeping the water there in terms of nanotechnology, bacterial, I know there are methods for, attempting cleanups of chemicals in the water that are based chemically. So is that one of the options being considered at any of these sites?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, mm-hmm. we are prepared to answer those questions, and I can introduce Paul Hoff right now, or we could finish... Director's presentation, whichever you prefer.
Okay. And how much, okay, I thought that was pretty close to the end of so I understand how the time is going, what else are you presenting before we get to that?
Madam Chair, I was just going to provide an update of where we're at with the information sharing.
Okay.
Three
Go ahead.
So far.
Okay, one more question here. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Sather, if you don't get the bonding money for the Washington County landfill, is there dollars in the environmental fund, which comes from the solid waste management tax, that can cover that, or is that simply just too big a... There's no solid waste fund anymore, so is there enough to cover it, or is that just too big a dollar item to do with cash on hand in the environmental fund? I'm just looking at different contingencies here.
Part of the closed landfill program was established back in 1994. It was basically, there was three main funding sources that supported the program, which was the bonding, it was the solid waste tax that currently goes into the environmental fund, which of course supports the remediation fund, which is the current funding source, and then also the financial insurance recovery dollars that we received from insurance carriers. Currently, we probably spend about $10 million a year out of the remediation fund for all closed landfill projects. If bonding wasn't available, we basically would have to look to the remediation fund and make some priority decisions as far as which sites would or wouldn't move forward, and that might have some impacts also on the Superfund program that also shares that fund, and it's dependent on balances that are available.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Just real quickly, just wanted to, part of the consent order, we also had an information sharing process where the MPCA was interested in getting information from 3M in their possession related to the PFCs, and we do have a plan in place, and all information requests that we had within that plan have been satisfied as of the end of November. The most recent one, which we just received on November 30th, that I we have our staff currently reviewing is the ambient air, excuse me, it was the taking a look at air emissions from the facilities, and that is something that we'll be spending some time on. Points of release from 3M operations in Minnesota into the ambient air. Also, we're holding regular scheduled meetings with 3M. We meet twice a month. And then 3M also is providing subject matter experts to the MPC and MDH, and we've already had three meetings on that, so that has been very helpful for both agencies. We also have one next week. They're bringing in Dr. Jennifer Fields from Oregon, who's a state researcher that's done a lot of work on wastewater treatment facilities and other types of things that will be of interest to both agencies. And then finally, part of the agreement also was to make sure that they shared information related to health and toxicological studies, and that is something that they are providing monthly reports to both PCA and MDH, mm-hmm. and then also continuing to share information to the Department of Health as needed mm-hmm. for their studies. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mr. Biggin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question that I had from a constituent was, being that there aren't a lot of studies about, like, the derma effects or whether this is airborne and if we're inhaling stuff, is there any sort of test, and I did speak to one of the assistants in your office about any tests, air quality tests in the area, and is that going to be part of the second half, too? He's shaking his head behind you.
I can speak to that issue.
Okay, if you wouldn't mind, but... yes, I just wanted to know if there were any airborne tests going in there.
Thank you, Director Sater. And then quickly to the in-ship view question and the airborne question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Biggin and members of the committee. I'm Paul Hoff. I'm the supervisor of the Environmental Reporting and Special Studies Unit at the PCA, and we appreciated your forwarding a couple of those constituent questions to us ahead of time. I'll speak first to the air quality question, as that's an area under development. We are beginning to monitor for air quality probably early next year. It's something that has not been done very much anywhere, and so there's been some methods development with our contract lab in Canada that had to happen first before we could actually go out and sample ambient air. And that has been underway, and we've agreed on some of the technical details of that, the filter medium and how you actually capture samples and over what period of time, to work out those technical details. And we'll be following up and actually doing sampling of the ambient air sometime early this coming year. With respect to the previous question about in-site treatment of PFCs in groundwater, we have been looking at that possibility. And for about 2 years now, we've been conducting an experiment with the U.S. EPA in cooperation with a lab of theirs in Oklahoma, where we took samples of groundwater from beneath, soil rather, from beneath the Washington County landfill, and then set up what we call microcosms, which are essentially jars, and then spiked them, dosed them, those jars, with known quantities of PFOS and PFOA, and then we essentially go away for a while and see what happens, because we have been surprised in the past that with some contaminants there has been a phenomenon called natural attenuation or natural breakdown, and we wondered if that might happen either biologically or physically. Unfortunately, the chemicals are so durable that so far in 2 years of the work on that experiment, we have not seen a breakdown. What we have observed is that there are sometimes changes in how tightly the PFOS or PFOA may absorb or adsorb to soil particles based on the amount of oxygen that's present in the water. So, kind of a technical answer to your question. Unfortunately, we're not very optimistic of in-site treatment in groundwater, as has been the case and has been been shown to be promising with the contaminant trichloroethylene, for example, and other situations like this. So we are going to certainly keep our eyes open and to the possibilities of other breakthroughs. So far, nanotechnology is still kind of out there, but not very promising as it pertains to a chemical as durable as the PFC family. Mm-hmm. And the last question, from your constituent, Mr. Rapp, and I would be glad to talk with him if he's here to give him more
talk
detail.
So he can give us a brief response on the total maximum daily load.
Right. The question is, what may be going on with creating a total maximum daily loads, which is a portion of the Federal Clean Water Act that you hear about for conventional pollutants all the time, and is now a possibility for PFCs, because we are in the 2008 cycle of listing impaired waters in the state, proposing to list, and this has been out for public comment for a while, the impaired lakes and sections of the Mississippi River where a fish consumption advisory is in place of one meal per month or more restrictive. Mm-hmm. A one meal per week advisory does not trigger that type of an impairment, but that has been our practice in the past with respect to mercury and dioxin and PCBs and other contaminants. So those will be listed as impairments. The practical matter is that the work that's going on now to investigate and remediate the disposal site and find out where else PFCs are present in the environment is very similar to what you would undertake in a TMDL study, the total maximum daily load, and the activity we have underway to set water quality criteria in the Mississippi River and in Lake Calhoun and anywhere else we need to is very, very similar to that. On the other hand, it's a good idea to have the other tools available to us under that Federal Clean Water Act should they be necessary. And it is fair to point out that some of the sources of PFCs in other places away from the sites in your district in eastern Washington County are not really known and not able to be attributed directly to a point source or to 3M. So we have our work cut out for us yet in that regard. Mm-hmm. And I would be glad if Mr. Rapp is here to speak with him later on with more detail.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative McNamara, you have a question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you having this hearing today. My questions are for Director Sather, if I could ask a couple. As you're coming up, you mentioned in the PowerPoint it showed 28 well advisories, but you mentioned agreement with only 20 of them. So that would leave me 8 residents that either don't want the charcoal filters or what, and I'm wondering, is there some help that we could help? Is there some people that need to understand that this is to their benefit? And I'm just curious, are you forthcoming? Are they going to be forthright here in getting them, or where are we at on that?
Madam Chair, given... I'm Doug Westbang. He's the Superfund supervisor, and his group works closely with these folks. And I know that we have gone out, and we can't get into their homes and install the system until we get an access agreement, so he'll be able to hopefully answer your question.
Madam Chair, members of the working group, there are a number of people who have elected to simply stay on bottled water. They prefer that, and we're not going to force a change. There are some folks whom we simply have not been able to connect with in terms of gaining access. We're trying to work that out with our contractors. We eventually believe that we will install all of the units in the homes of those people who want them before very long. It's just a matter of logistics. They need to be home, and schedules have to meet.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And if specifically, if any of them are my constituents and you need help reaching out to them, please let me know. My other question, Director, is in regards to the closed landfill. Do we have a past history of where people that may or may not have had responsibility for what's in the closed landfill to come forward? Mm-hmm. And where you made mention
of the $8 million that 3M is making available, but the cost potentially are $23 million. Do we have any precedent historically of this happening in other places, and what has it been?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, this is actually unique. When the closed landfill program was created in 1994, basically we took in a lot of insurance money from the various carriers for these sites and agreed to take over the responsibility for these sites as a state. So this is a unique situation where we've had one party offer to provide some additional funding for the cleanup of that site.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Director, if I could ask you, do we know who's responsible for what's in this landfill that we're concerned about that we want to spend $23 million for?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, this is not, this site was actually, you know, it was a dump that was used by multiple parties over the years, and it was a point where obviously where PFC waste were dumped, but then there was also multiple other other sources also that would have done that. And again, part of the closed landfill program is there's probably hundreds of folks that we could go after, but to have it all be in one site now and use the insurance money to kind of go for that, it makes it a lot easier than trying to find out who all those sources are. And that's even be able to determine who all they are would be very difficult.
To clarify on that, so once you, because of the closed landfill program, partly that is so that you don't have to any longer go after them, that you have this insurance fund, and so rather than tracking down every party over the many, many years that might have contributed to the site, particularly when there's a large number, you don't pursue that anymore like you would with Superfund sites and other situations?
Sam Chair, that's correct. These sites all previously were in the Superfund program, mm-hmm. and it was the difficulty that we were having in the past as far as just the multiple people that were involved, that it made sense to come up with a program where the state assumed the responsibility to manage those.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do know you go after everybody because I got letters as a contractor wondering who my insurance carrier was and if I dumped in this landfill and if I dumped in that landfill. And they were for many years prior to whenever the work was. Well, one other question in regards to, you mentioned the consultant evaluates the six remedial sites. What's the background of a consultant that would do some work like that?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I have Doug Daniels, the supervisor of the closed landfill program, that works with the contractor that will best be able to answer that question.
Okay. Madam Chair of the committee, my name is Doug Day. I'm a supervisor for the closed landfill program, CPCA. The study that was referenced was done by our contractor, Short Elliott Hendrickson. They're a national firm, and we actually worked with those folks out of their Chippewa Falls office. They were senior representatives representing them that were pretty much the top of the line for the work they do. These were not just general folks out of their St. Paul offices. These were senior level people that were involved in that study.
Mr. McNamara, you had a follow-up?
Yeah, just real quick. And their background, their scientific or engineering background?
It was a combination. There were a number of folks. I don't have all of them listed here in front of me, but there were engineers, senior-level scientists, hydrologists.
Mm-hmm. That's why okay. I was wondering. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Wayne,
thank you. The point of the closed landfill program was to make sure that pollutants were not migrating into the groundwater and that was your responsibility once you had the money. In this particular landfill, how much was still wandering away from the site? What percentage after you closed it and put the cap on it?
Madam Chair, Representative Guinness and Committee, that's a difficult response to try to make. We know that when we inherited that landfill, the ongoing pump-out system was effectively removing or keeping the bulk organic contamination from leaving the site. It was not until we learned about the PFC contamination, we realized that was not being addressed as part of the treatment, and that occurred when we learned about that in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So the plume was contained for the things you were looking for with your treatment.
That is correct.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know.
Good clarification. Thank you. Well, thank you all. And we are going to move on to the next phase. And for those of you in the audience, those from 3M who are going to initiate the presentation should come up. For everyone in the room, just want you to know that I expect we are going to be here beyond 5 o'clock today. I know that we originally indicated to 3M they could have 30 minutes or so, and I expect that there'll probably be some discussion and questions after that, and possibly some response also from Department of Health as well if they want to continue remarks after that. So my guess is we'll be here at least till 5:15, if not a bit longer than that. I want to make sure, since they took the time to come here today, that we'll hear what they have to say and that we have time to respond with some questions. Yeah. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jean Sweeney, and I'm Vice President for Environment, Health, and Safety Operations at 3M. I am recently appointed to the position, and I am replacing Dr. Catherine Reed, who has elected to retire. In fact, about 2 hours ago, we had a retirement party, so she's off on to other things in her life. Today, I just want to make a few just short comments to say that we appreciate the opportunity to follow the process outlined in the consent order, and also appreciate the good working relationship we've had with MPCA in this process. And I agree with Ms. Taylor's comment that we are on track. The progress is continuing per the order and sequence outlined in the consent order. And we are meeting all of our obligations to the best of our knowledge to be able to achieve the goals that are outlined in the consent order. So I feel very confident that we will be able to stay on track and stay with the process as been outlined. And I'm sure that we'll be able to continue to do so. So that's my short comment. Although I do want to add that in answer to the question about...
We are having a little bit of difficulty hearing you. Could you be a little closer to the mic or raise it up a little bit?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Is that better?
Not really.
Well, other than sitting on top of it. I wanted to answer the question about, the question was raised about what kind of notice we had sent regarding the Oakdale public meeting. Mm-hmm. And we, through our public relations organization, we sent out a notice to the Oakdale paper that was both a press release and a legal notice. The legal notice was run, and that was sent in advance. They elected not to run the press release. We also sent press releases to Pioneer Press and Star and Tribune. Tribune did not run theirs, but the Pioneer Press ran an online ran the press release on their online website the day prior to the meeting. Then also we did have a notice, public notice was published on the Oakdale City website, so that was available for anyone who chose to go on to the city website to see that that notice was there. In addition to that, because particularly in the Oakdale site, we have 65 residents that live on the perimeter right directly around the site. We had sent them a letter in advance, first of all, to notify them that the fence was going to go up so that they would be aware that the fence was going to be erected, and to know why it was being erected. And also in that letter we stated the date and time and purpose of the public meeting. So we will, in addition to that, the last piece I'll say is that we have sent notice to all of our employees who live in Oakdale, which are a large number of employees that live in the area. So we had notice done in a variety of different ways, and we will follow the same procedure for both the Woodbury and Cottage Grove site to do for both public notice and on the city's website and notice to our employees.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that? Is about approximately how many residents did you have appear, show up at the meeting in Oakdale?
I would estimate we had about 40 residents, I would say. Okay. And not just residents, we had a mixture of people, but residents, I would guess maybe 40 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Now, I'm going to pass it on to Dr. Zobel and Dr. Butenhoff to present the research findings.
Mm-hmm. Good afternoon. I'm Larry Zobel, corporate medical director at 3M. I think I've met most of you. My primary task now is, I'll be here for questions, but I want to introduce Dr. John Butenhoff to you today, who will present the presentation that's coming up on the screen now. John is a corporate scientist at 3M, which is the highest technical level in the company. John is internationally recognized for his work in fluorochemical toxicology. He has over 30 peer-reviewed publications in the area. He's an invited speaker at international conferences on this subject, and I would it would be a challenge, I would say, to find any recently published articles on fluorochemical toxicology that did not reference his work. He'll today talk about recent developments in PFBA toxicology, with emphasis on the 90-day study and the relevance of those findings to humans.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to present our research program on PFBA. I think the Dr. Gayden from MDH has given you an overview. I'll go into a bit more detail as I progress through this. I'm going to talk about four basic topics, and I apologize to those of you who are sitting kind of in the stands. I perhaps was expecting a larger screen, so we do have a handout for the committee members, though. But first, we'll go over a brief review of the prior and new information that we've obtained on PFBA, demonstrating a relatively low level of toxicity and that the effects are what we would consider to be somewhat adaptive, non-adverse, and reversible. We've been able to establish clear no-effect levels in these studies. We'll also discuss the rapid elimination of the material in animals and humans, which is partly responsible for its lower toxicity and leads to low blood levels in the exposed population. We'll also talk about a biomonitoring study that we have conducted in the affected areas, which shows minimal exposure and minimal accumulation potential in people. And also, I'll finish by a bit of a more technical discussion on some of the differences between rodents and humans on some of the endpoints that we've seen in these studies. First of all, when this issue kind of came to my attention in the spring of 2006, one of our first questions was, what is known about the toxicology of PFBA? I was able to find 8 papers in the peer-reviewed scientific literature that had been published up to that time. What's important to note is that all of these papers also included PFOA as a test compound, so we were able to actually make direct comparisons between PFBA and PFOA from those citations. Not to go into much detail about those, because we don't really have time today, but just to give you kind of the highlights from the published literature that was available, it showed evidence of a biological process we call PPAR-alpha activation in both rats and mice. This is significant because a lot is known about PPAR-alpha activation. It's been a kind of a target of pharmaceutical development for cardiovascular drugs that protect against some of the inflammatory and hyperlipidemia processes that are associated with cardiovascular disease. Also, there were variable liver weight increases. In some studies you would see it, in other studies you wouldn't. There was no weight loss as opposed to PFOA studies, or decreased weight gain. No oxidative damage to DNA at relatively high concentrations in isolated cells. And we also saw some evidence of activation of the thyroid receptor. I'll talk a little bit more about that later as well. And then rapid elimination in monkeys. This was from a study that we had actually conducted in about the 2000-2001 time frame when we were looking at switching our chemistry. What's important here is that in the same monkeys, we tested several compounds, and in these monkeys with PFOA, their elimination half-lives were on the order of 20 to 30 days. In this case, it was 1.7 or approximately 2 days, so about a tenfold difference between PFOA and PFBA in elimination. All in all, these studies showed us that PFBA was less biologically active than PFOA, perhaps because of some of the pharmacokinetic or elimination differences, but also it appeared to be somewhat less active just from a potency perspective. Since that time, we've started a number of studies. I don't expect you to actually see this, but I just want to kind of give you an idea that there have been quite a few studies that have been conducted since the spring of 2006. We haven't done this in isolation. We've had a number of research partners that are listed here in parentheses. I do want to make one comment about toxicological studies, because I don't think lay people understand this very well, and that is when we design a tox study, we actually want to produce an effect. So we try to get the dose levels up at a high enough level to see effects, and the purpose of that is so that we can understand what effects might be at higher levels of exposure and what the no effect levels would be at lower levels of exposure. And therefore, we really expect to see effects in toxicological studies. And this doesn't mean that those effects would be expected at the much lower levels of exposure that people may be exposed to in the environment. I'll switch back to what we call pharmacokinetics for a second. This is how effectively a material is kind of taken up and eliminated from the body. And from an elimination perspective, as has already been alluded to this afternoon, PFDA in all of the species that we've studied, mice, rats, monkeys, and humans, is eliminated quite readily. Particularly in humans, we see in two separate studies that we've conducted about a 2 to 4 day elimination half-life. I'll remind you that the elimination half-life for PFOA in humans was about 1,300 days. So there's several hundred-fold difference between PFDA and PFOA in elimination half-life. This is important because pharmacokinetic adjustment factors have been used in setting health-based values, and so this is an important parameter. From the standpoint of the potential effects on mutation or genotoxicity, as we call it, there really have been no indications in three separate studies in fairly sensitive test systems. Also, we worked with the US EPA laboratory, the developmental biology lab, in, with Dr. Christopher Lau to design a study in collaboration also with the MDH staff that would give us good comparative information with PFOA. The EPA lab had published a study on PFOA in 2006, so this study was designed to mimic the PFOA study. We worked with renowned pharmacokineticists to try to develop the dose levels so that we would have comparable dose levels. We had to adjust the dose levels 35 times higher for PFDA than PFOA to get equivalent body burdens during exposure. This is a quick slide I'm not going to go over in detail, which Chris Lau and I have prepared on just kind of a quick overview of that developmental study. We also have conducted several repeat dose studies. These vary in duration from 5 days to 90 days. I will talk primarily about the 90-day study results. This is a study that was requested by MDH and that we have tried to complete in as timely a fashion as possible. Also, as has been alluded to, this is kind of the standard of practice, if you will, for risk assessment and setting of values to have a comparison over a longer time period in toxicity. But before I talk about those results, I'd like to kind of talk a little bit about what happens in the body, particularly the body of a rat, when it's exposed to a drug or a chemical. And I'm without going into a lot of detail, because this can be fairly complicated, but generally you have things which you call xenobiotic inducers, which are drugs or chemicals. There are also materials in the body that the body makes that have the same action. And, for example, if we take PFDA, it will interact with structures in the cells that are called receptors or transcription factors. And I mentioned PPAR alpha earlier. There's another one that comes into play, as it turns out, with PFDA called CAR. And these transcription factors basically turn on the process for creating what I'll call blueprints for building proteins, which we call messenger RNA. And those proteins then try to metabolize either the substances that have induced this process or other substances. And the ones that kind of come into play with PFBA are things like fatty acids, or FA, in the handout I gave you, T4, which Helen Gaydon had alluded to earlier, which is thyroxin, the thyroid hormone, and bilirubin is another case of this. So for the 90-day study, what were the outcomes in that study? primarily males were affected. These were male rats. The noted effects at the high dose in the study were an increase in liver weight, reduced thyroid hormone in the blood, while maintaining normal physiological function or even slightly elevated physiological function at the high dose, and then a slight increase in thyroid cell size and potentially number. In the mid and high dose, we also saw a reduction in bilirubin, which is actually a waste product of the degradation of heme. And we should really review or view that as a protective thing, because bilirubin is actually toxic if it builds up in the body. And we know from some of the ancillary studies that we've done that this is due to this upregulation of metabolic processes. Important things we didn't see in the 90-day study are effects on body weight or weight gain. There was no evidence of what we would call liver injury or thyroid injury, and no marked progression of the effects from the 28-day study to the 90-day study. Another question that we had was, how are people being exposed? What are the exposure levels in the community? We were able to take advantage of approximately 200 samples that we had from medical exams of 3M employees who lived in the affected area. We asked them if they would be willing to let us look at serum samples that we had retained frozen from a 2005 medical exam program, and 177 of these employees volunteered to have us do that. These were employees with no occupational exposure to PFBA. They came from 9 cities, and the cities are listed on the left-hand column. As you can see, approximately 3/4 or 72% of those individuals had blood PFBA levels that were less than the current detection limit of 0.5 parts per billion. 96% of them were under 2 parts per billion, with just a few a bit higher than that, with the highest value being 6.3 parts per billion. If you compare those data to the serum concentrations at the end of the 90-day study in the male rat, you'll see that there's a very large difference in thousands, actually. So, for example, our highest value from our biomonitoring program was 6.3 parts per billion. At the low dose in our 90-day study, 24 hours after the last dose, the male rats had a serum concentration of 6,900 parts per billion. Now, by this time, they had already excreted probably at least half of what they had taken on 24 hours earlier. And one of the more better comparisons is area under the curve, but that's a complicated thing that I'm not going to get into today. But suffice it to say that the community levels are, you know, at least 1,000 times lower than levels that are associated with a lack of toxicological effects in rats. I'll talk for a moment now on the liver enlargement effect with PFBA. This was the main effect from PFBA treatment in rats. I believe that most of the other effects stem from the processes that cause this liver enlargement. We know from the molecular biology work that we've done that this seems to be due to an activation of these two receptors, PPAR alpha and CAR. And these findings represent a normal liver response to upregulation of metabolism that, in this case, is non-adverse and entirely reversible on cessation of exposure. So how are humans different in this response than rodents? It's not that PPAR alpha isn't applicable to humans. In fact, there are drugs that are designed to activate PPAR alpha, but the liver enlargement response is greatly attenuated, and the cell proliferation response that can occur with these types of compounds is also absent, in humans, and there are a number of studies that demonstrate this. Therefore, the effects that we've observed here in these studies would be expected to be greatly reduced or even absent in humans, particularly at the levels of exposure that we see in the environment. I've just listed here several of the many papers in the scientific literature that deal with rat versus human differences in PPAR alpha response. I'll talk next about the effect on thyroid endpoints. Basically, PFDA is acting in two ways to affect thyroid-related endpoints. First, we know from some work that we've done that PFDA can displace loosely bound PFDA hormone in rats. Thyroxin hormone is carried on carrier proteins. There's about almost 1,000 times more carried than is active or free. And in rats, they lack a specific carrier protein for thyroid hormone, so it's more labile. We also know that we've increased the amount of an enzyme that can metabolize thyroid hormone and result in its excretion in urine and bile, both through CAR and PPAR alpha activation. We did see histologically, looking under the microscope, a thyroid gland response. The thyroid needs to work a little bit harder to replace the lost hormone. This was minimal to slight in nature and completely reversible on cessation of exposure. Rats are more sensitive to these endpoints than humans. Humans have a much smaller proportion of thyroid hormone that is displaceable. Nearly 70% of our thyroid hormone is on a very specific protein that holds on to the hormone very tightly. Also, the upregulation of metabolism of the hormone is less in humans, in part because they're less sensitive to one of the nuclear factors that upregulates this, and secondly, our metabolism rates are generally slower. And these differences are very widely recognized. I've got another list of papers that deals with this subject. I think in conclusion, we can say that in rats and mice, the effects that we've seen represent normal, reversible biochemical adaptations, and there really are no substantial developmental effects either. In humans, we know that we are less sensitive to rats and mice to some of these adaptation processes. We know that PFDA is eliminated readily and will not accumulate substantially on repeated exposure, and that community blood levels are at least 1,000 times lower than levels associated with a lack of toxicological effects in rats. I'd like to just close by acknowledging some of our research partners that have been involved either substantially or by giving us advice and guidance in this program. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Zobel. Dr. Zobel, did you have any other thing else to comment on this, or at the end of the presentation?
No, that's it.
Okay, members of the working group, questions? We'll start on the end.
Dr. Rao and Dr. Abbott are with the U.S. EPA. Do you know if these are the same specialists who are working with our own Department of Health on this study?
I'm not really sure who has been consulted by MDH. I don't believe that Dr. Lau has been consulted because I'm in communication with him quite frequently.
Mm-hmm. So may I ask if the Department of Health is still here, if they are consulting with these same specialists at the U.S. EPA? Yes. Very good. Thank you. My question.
Mm-hmm. And Representative Wilkinson?
Thank you. Generally, when things affect humans, it's not just one thing that comes into a body, and the same with that. So we're looking at this in isolation. Have we looked at this compound together with whatever else may be out there, which is likely to be out there in the water that people are drinking?
DFOAs, DFOSs, and other things, because the real world is not an isolated thing.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Lagunias, I'm not aware of any published studies that are currently available that are looking at combinations of TFCs. We do actually have a research program that is pursuing that, looking at human liver cells and rat liver cells at the University of Minnesota. And that's something that we are working with the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology on, but that work is not completed yet.
Mm-hmm. Follow up?
Yes, it's hard to draw any conclusions because what you have done is not particularly related to real-world exposure, because in the real world, people drink water that just doesn't have one thing in it. The other thing I'm concerned about is most of the endocrine disruptor studies say that the effects are not at really high levels or but they see the effects at extremely low levels, and high levels don't seem to have the same outcome. So I think the question I have you looked at outcomes at extremely low levels and looked at things like reproductive outcomes?
Madam Chair, Representative Lagunias, we haven't done specific animal studies like that. I think in our medical monitoring programs with our exposed employees, we have looked at a number of things, including 11 different hormones and how exposures to TFOA and TFOS may affect those hormones. And all of that's been published in the scientific literature. There have been some studies, that comes to mind, that was published in Japan, looking at the relationship in pregnant women and their offspring at birth for thyroid hormone, which did not see an effect, and relating that back to TFOS concentration. But that type of work has not been done for TFDA specifically.
Mm-hmm.
If I could just add something to that, Representative. Right now, the regulatory process at the federal level and at all the state levels that I know of follow the traditional toxicology paradigm of dose is an important factor, and effects are dose related, and that's generally the way these are done. I would also add, in addition to John's earlier response to your other question, that the although this is a study on a single compound, that's again is the standard way of studying single compounds, and the question of how you study mixtures is one that's been ongoing in toxicology for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So, Lagunias?
Thank you. I understand that this is the current protocol. But it has been mightily criticized as not relating to the real world. And, of course, I mean, that's an old way of doing business, and newer ways of doing business don't look at the same, you know, this kind of model of testing. Mm-hmm. And it is troubling to me that we are only looking at this one in isolation, because that's not the water that folks drink. And so it's not comforting to know that, well, sure, we're studying it according to the old federal model, but that's not new science. That's not what the scientists are telling us the way we should study things today.
Representative, in response to that, I think I would say that the Department of Health has suggested that compounds be looked at using a hazard index, and to account for the presence of other compounds in water by use of the hazard index, so that you would look at each compound in relationship to its its HRL or HBV, and if they have common endpoints, then you would consider them together in an additive fashion. And so you are, when you get actually into looking at any particular water source, you do consider out of the section mm-hmm. that way.
Mm-hmm. So we're gonna,
but we don't know whether they work in additive fashion or whether they work in a multiplier fashion, and that's the basic question.
Do you have a response to that in terms of whether we know anything about that at all?
Madam Chair, Representative Leganius, I don't have a specific response. I think one of the reasons that the field of toxicology has moved more into doing some of these ancillary studies, mm-hmm. it's very uncommon to do the types of studies that we've done and include the molecular biology endpoints that we included. We did that because we wanted to understand how these materials were acting. You know, we can easily measure liver weight and look under the microscope at the liver, but we also wanted to know how that was working biochemically so that we could actually put that into the context of what we knew about other things that act like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a, as I mentioned earlier, there's a huge literature on PPAR alpha activation and CAR activation, because both of those processes have been used for drug development. And so there's a lot of human data, a lot of animal data that we can relate back to. Now, it may not address your specific concern, but I think it gives us some comfort that we really have a very strong basis in our biological understanding mm-hmm. of what's going on mm-hmm. with this compound.
Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if it's for Dr. Zobel or Dr. Butenoff. I'm curious to know the same question I asked. I'm hoping I'll get more than at least a nickel out of you. I couldn't get anything out of the Department of Health. But in regards to the health-based value, you've had an opportunity to look at the studies, and you've talked about the substantial difference that PFDA is showing. Are you making a recommendation to the Department of Health to set it at a certain level? And what are you recommending to them?
Sure.
Go for it. I want to know what happens behind those closed doors.
Yeah. Well, I want to be responsive. I think that we would, the data would drive us to look at, to think a number would be, you know, 100 parts per billion or so, that neighborhood for this compound. I think there'd be a couple ways of getting there, but just to put it in perspective with PFOA, as John has mentioned, we have a lot of comparative data with PFOA. We know that PFDA is less than 10 times as potent, and we know it leaves the body hundreds of times faster, so you can do the math and you'd come up with, by that comparison, 100 or more, 200 times the level for PFOA.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, if I can just have. So Dr. Zobel, in a real simple lay term that somebody like myself can understand, our constituents, are you telling us that this chemical that is, I'll call it second generation Scotchgard, if we call it, unfortunately, Representative Flawless' constituents had the first or whatever generation mm-hmm. it was. This is a completely different ingredient. It's completely different, and you're saying it potentially. You're saying it could substantiate a health-based value way different than its previous generation one, and that our constituents should understand that this is something that is completely different than the previous generation do, with that four triangles instead of eight triangles or whatever mm-hmm. those were on you.
Representative, there's a very significant difference between the longer chain compounds like PFOA and PFOS and these shorter chain compounds like PFDA in terms of both their potency, biological potency, and the length of time that stay in the body, which means the potential to build up in the body just is minimal.
Just one more and then I'll be done. I want to say we're appreciative of the $8 million for the Washington Colony landfill. there would be an opportunity for discussions to us to be more appreciative, and I hope you all have those discussions with the MPCA. And Dr. Zobel, you know, I mean that truthfully. I think it's shown by the fact that 177 of the 3M employees were willing to subject themselves to a study when you had 200 originally. These are good people that have worked for you. They're good people living in the community, and you're a good company in what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And we appreciate that. The department has said, and I appreciate the fact that we're going outside of just you to get the study and so that we have a good transparency. But I hope, and I was hoping you'd bring Dr. Reed with you. I see that she probably wasn't able to make it. But I hope you will bring back to the powers to be that we appreciate what you've done, and we're certainly open, and we will push the department's hard.
Thank you for your comments, Representative. But I would point out that Jean Sweeney is here behind me. She has replaced Dr. Reed, who has wisely retired at this point.
Well, then if you don't mind, Madam Chair, I wouldn't mind if Vice President Sweeney could come up for a minute. Congratulations, Madam Vice President.
Thank you.
I hope that you will bring back to the boardroom the discussion that we appreciate you as a terrific employer. And I will say, I had two uncles that spent a career decades long at the Chemelite. Three different uncles that spent their career there, and it's a great employer. And we appreciate that. And I hope you will. I am serious. I may say it in a lighthearted way, but we appreciate what you've done, and we'll appreciate it even more as we go forward. And I guess I would ask if you're open to the discussion.
Well, Representative McNamara, that certainly is my job to take your concern back to our senior executives and express your concern with them or your request, and I will be doing that, and we will take it under consideration. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Bigham.
Thanks. Is there any scientific difference between repeated exposure and constant exposure? Maybe tomato, tomato, but I'm just wondering if there's a scientific, like in the legal field, we have the Black's Law Dictionary. Is there a scientific dictionary that you have to use different standards when you're judging repeated exposure and constant exposure?
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, that's actually a very good question. In design of these studies, for example, the 28-day study and the 90-day study that you've heard about, what happens is the rats will get a dose once a day, but that dose basically gets absorbed and it stays in their body and is excreted to a certain extent during that time period. With, depending on the how fast it's eliminated, with repeated daily exposures, it can build up to a certain point. If it's eliminated fairly rapidly, it's only a few exposures and it reaches kind of a steady state maximum concentration. For example, with PFOS, what we found in repeating exposures is that every day you would give a dose, you'd ratchet up their serum concentrations a little bit more, and that would just kind of continue for most of the study. But in this case, we reach steady state fairly quickly, and you can look at how much is kind of in the body during that time period, and so it is really a constant exposure. Mm-hmm. It's not a constant concentration because it's getting absorbed and there's kind of a peak concentration and then it begins to get eliminated and the concentration goes down a bit. But it is a constant exposure during the course of the study. And we use different dose levels to get different levels of constant exposure. There have been other, you know, types of studies that can be done to do the same thing. We chose to do it this way because it was probably most analogous to the way people were being exposed.
Thank you.
Thanks. So the short answer is no.
For
PFOS.
No, you don't need to repeat it, but I guess that's what I'm gathering is it's your opinion that you don't think there's a real difference between repeated and constant as far as...
No, not in this case, no.
Of the 177 people that were tested for the biomonitoring, are you aware of any of them that were expecting with HR?
I'm not. No, I'll defer to my colleague Gary Olson. No, we're not.
So none of them were. Okay.
Yeah, sure. I'd like to introduce Dr. Gary Olson, who's our epidemiologist at 3M.
Madam Chair, working panel members, the answer to your question is we would not know that for certain, but it would be unlikely. Most of these were either active employees, former employees, or retirees, and so their age was higher than what I would say would be from the general population. So if there were any, there would be probably very few.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any plans to repeat a test that would involve maybe your employees and exposure if they were expecting? Or had recent, or their children, anything of those sorts? Any plans?
We have no plans currently, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a, couple of last questions. Again, you know, 3M's headquarters is in my district. You've done a good job with Oakdale and what is happening there. We do appreciate that. We just continue to have concerns and are hoping to get some of those addressed. My understanding in your presentation is very thorough. I almost wish we had had it at the beginning. With this study that's coming out with the EPA, are there concerns with PFBA specifically and what's happening with the development of kids, pregnant mothers that are having kids that are having, as I understood it, with, and these are unpublished yet, but both low birth weights, is there a correlation? Have you found that? Or
In the PFPA developmental study that was conducted in Dr. Lau's lab, no, we really didn't see any effect on low birth weight.
Is that the, Madam Chair, is that the study that's coming out?
That's the study that's being prepared for publication, yes.
Madam Chair, go ahead. Was there any correlation with developmental delays or any projected developmental delays?
Madam Chair, Representative Slowick, there was a slight delay in eye opening at some doses, which is not really considered a substantive effect. It's really more of a small growth delay. And remember that these doses are quite high. We saw effects in the moms with respect to liver weight at the highest dose. So I would say that that's the only thing really that would be in that study of that nature.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. I just, and that's worrisome. Even though it's the only thing, we worry about that on our end, and I hope we'll continue to look at this issue, and if we need to do biomonitoring of mothers in particular, or if we need to offer bottled water to mothers in particular, or if we should build filtration plants in these areas, or, you know, there's a number of things that we wonder if we should be doing. And you know what? You know so much more than me, and all of you do, and you've been working on this a lot longer than I ever have. But we just want to make sure that the health of the public is protected, and we're trying to figure that out. So if you can continue to help us with that, and as these studies come out, help us understand what that means, and as our constituents have concerns, if we can help us continue to educate the public and us to make sure, obviously, we're not affecting the next generation of Minnesotans in our area, because, mm-hmm. as we all know, that would be devastating, and we would not want to do that. So we would appreciate any kind of update in the future, and Madam Chair, I know this is going to be an ongoing hearing.
Regarding the update issue, Dr. Butenhoff, since you're in regular contact with Dr. Lau, can you give us any indication of what journal or what timeline exists for the publication? Are you aware of it?
Madam Chair, I don't wish to speak for Dr. Lau, but I will say that I know he's working very hard on that. It takes a tremendous amount of time mm-hmm. to prepare a scientific publication. Mm-hmm. I would say in my discussions with him that, you know, we've discussed, because 3M will be an author on that publication mm-hmm. as well, mm-hmm. we've discussed
a couple journals, one being Toxicological Sciences and the other Toxicology.
When determined.
But mm-hmm. that will be determined when the manuscript has been fully prepared.
Okay, thank you. Dr.
Zobel? Madam Chair, if I could add one comment, I'd like to repeat something that Dr. Gayden said earlier when she was up here and that John has alluded to. I think it's important to note, and I don't know if it's, I find it reassuring, but whether other people will, the most sensitive endpoints for this material are not developmental and are not found in the fetus or during development or to pregnant moms. The most sensitive endpoints are the ones we're talking about in terms of the effects on the liver and the thyroid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So that the if we protect people against those effects, we will protect people against those the effects that you're concerned about. And I think mm-hmm. it's, I think that is something that we can take from the toxicology studies.
Senator Saltzman, do you have
It seems to me, Chair, that we saw some information from the health department regarding cancer rates in Washington County, and it was and there was no difference. And so I guess I'm wondering in President Swalwood's comments, if birth information is available, to just kind of get a sense of in Washington County, because certainly I think in my district, 50% of kids, or I believe that 50% of the homes have kids, so they're obviously having children. So I guess I just raised that, is there an opportunity there, and I'm not a health statistician again, so, but maybe as something to just look at, and I'm not sure if that's possible, if that's public information, but is that something to look at, and maybe it's so sensitive that you wouldn't notice it, but it might be something to just suggest to the Department of Health how that might be able to be done.
Madam Chair, if I may, I just wanted to make a comment. It doesn't relate to PFDA, but we've looked at probably close to 400, I don't remember the exact number, employees with exposure to PFOA and PFOS, who their body burdens would be considerably higher than those from affected areas in the water, and looked at least birth weight as an outcome, and that is smack dab on the national average without any births that were underweight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a study, I think, that we've provided to the health department.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think we're at a decision point here, and I would like Dr. Ewell could stay there for just sort of maybe push to one side over to the left. And Director Stein, if you could step up, I just want to ask you how you might like to proceed and discuss the options for a moment. There has been a larger number of questions than we anticipated today in the response here. This is very important information, and so we are running over. But at the same time, I'd originally indicated that once you all to give a response to anything either has been said in terms of the liver or thyroid input sensitivity issues, or since Representative McNamara asked the question about HPV levels, that was raised as well. I personally would love to hear a response today, but I want to respect people's time. So the options would be to continue for maybe 10 more minutes today and let you have up to that and let you respond in any way you'd like to, or we could, since you now are out in February at least for an HD value and not January, that we could early January have you come back and give a response. Did you have an opinion on this, or also other members of the working group, if you would like to offer your input into this decision?
Madam Chair, we would probably like to just respond today, simply because we're here and we're all thinking about what's just been discussed. It's probably more effective to respond right now.
Well, I appreciate everyone's patience with that. So if you'd like to bring up who you think is appropriate, Director Stein will let you respond on those, kind of probably on those three main key points, or at least the two main points of the thyroid sensitivity and endpoints in humans with BRAF and also the liver issue. And the major summaries, maybe one way to simplify it for us is to, the list of the
bottom of the second to last page on the outcomes of 90-day study in rats and important non-effects, either comment on those two or on, in addition to the liver and thyroid effects. Or whatever you think is
sure,
seen
Madam
appropriate.
Chair, and just a few thoughts from my perspective of what a risk assessment that the health department completes is and what a scientific research project is. Are the research projects that are done, toxicity studies on laboratory animals, are to understand the nature and consequence of dosing animals with chemicals over a period of time. And there is no scientific disagreement between 3M and the department on what happened during the dosing. The questions really pertain to the nature of the exposures and the potential for lifelong exposures in terms of eliminating. I noted that Dr. Butenoff mentioned that a number of the effects, or at least one of the effects that he referenced, was reversible upon cessation of the exposure. Mm-hmm. We're not considering cessation of exposure when we talk about a risk assessment for human exposure. We're talking about the possibility of being exposed to a compound over a lifetime. And so there's a slight difference in the way we characterize risks. And so that we incorporate a number of uncertainties. One of the questions that Representative Wagenius asked was, what about multiple pathways for exposure that may not be fully understood at the present time, given the extent of research that's available today? Mm-hmm. What about the possibility of multiple chemical relationships that are not fully understood at the present time? We incorporate uncertainty factors into our calculation of these values to account for those facts, mm-hmm. or those unknowns, I should say. And so it is... That's the context that I want to start with, and then I'd ask Dr. Gayden to specifically respond to any of the comments that were made by Dr. Butenoff or Dr. Zobel.
Thank you, Dr. Gayden. Go ahead.
Madam Chairman, speaking to the liver effects, such as the liver enlargement that Dr. Butenoff talked about, for PFOA PFOS, we chose not to use that endpoint when it was exhibited in rodents for that very reason. And we chose to use the primate information that we have. Unfortunately, we don't have primate information on TFDA. But we also feel again, though, that liver enlargement would not be information on TFDA. But we also feel again, though, that liver enlargement would not be a preferred endpoint for us to select for extrapolating to humans. But we do feel some of the other liver effects, such as cholesterol effects, et cetera, would be relevant. Mm-hmm. There does seem to be consensus in the scientific community that with liver proliferation, cell proliferation in the liver that leads eventually to tumors in rodents, you would not see that in humans. Mm-hmm. Likewise, there's a scientific consensus that for the thyroid, increases in follicular cell proliferation, et cetera, leads to tumors in rats. You would be unlikely to see tumors in humans. Mm-hmm. While rats are likely to see tumors, there still are some other changes that occurred in the thyroid that may be relevant to humans. We've taken their hypothesis in terms of relevance to humans very seriously, and that's why we've solicited expert opinion on that. And so far there does not seem to be a consensus that those endpoints would not be relevant to humans, but we're still pursuing that.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to point out one concern about the decreased body weight, birth weight in humans that seems to be considering coming up repeatedly. The study that was done by John Hopkins did not find that infants were clinically low birth weight infants. They saw an association with as PFOA and PFOS levels went up. There was a very, very small decrease in birth weight that was well within the normal range of birth weight and would not have normally even been picked up clinically.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no evidence at this point that that is an adverse effect in mm-hmm. those infants. I just wanted to clarify that because it seems like there's a lot of concern about birth weight effects in humans, and that's really sort of the state of that information at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if my explanation so far are we have not made an absolutely definitive decision on what critical endpoint we're going to be using for developing a health-based value for TFBA, but we prefer not to use the liver enlargement. At this point, we've made that decision.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, if I could just refer to one of Dr. Zobel's comments when Representative McNamara asked about the level. He associated relative values between PFOA and PFBA. I would just want to remind the working group members that it is based. Those comments are based on a very finite set of data that are available, and we would again apply some uncertainty factors given the fact that we have a relatively few number of documented and peer-reviewed studies to rely upon in publishing a health-based value. So while I want to respect 3M's advice and opinion, it wouldn't be fair to from our standpoint to simply make that direct correlation because of the uncertainties that I've already discussed.
Mm-hmm. Professor McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think Director Stein, I appreciate that, and you and I, from day one, I've said I hope this will be science-based as we move forward. But, and you've noted it, Representative Wagenius's comments need to be taken into account. Absolutely, we don't live in a glass house here with only the one chemical, and I hope you will take that into consideration. As she has mentioned, we have a number of different things. Fish advisories and all the different things happening in our area that, I know affect different chemicals, but we do want it to be science-based. I think our constituents expect us to be conservative in our approach, but to use the science that we know, and if we don't know, I hope you will take that into account.
Absolutely.
In terms of the issue of the HCV value, I assume your opening remarks were your answer to as to why there might be a difference between what you all determine
correct.
And come up with later.
That is correct.
In relation to the comment made on a number from 3M. Is there anything else that you wanted to comment in response to them? I was going to ask Dr. Hufnagel to give just a short response if you'd like to in response to Dr. Gayden just to wrap it up. But anything else you'd like to add?
No, unless there are specific questions from okay. from.
Anything else
in
the working
table.
Group?
Yes. On the water filter study, I know that there is this report coming out, and then there's an extended study.
Yes.
And because consumers are watching this, can you help me to understand, and perhaps the public understand, that when this initial report comes out, is that going to be useful in determining which water filter to buy, or should we be encouraging the public to wait until the final study is done? And that's sort of where I'm coming from, because we're obviously investing significant money in the second phase.
Yep.
And in doing that, I just would like to have a sense of, is everybody going to rush to Home Depot or wherever the day after this report comes out, or is this sort of a preliminary finding?
Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman, the study that we just received looked at a variety of filtration technologies. It will be, in our opinion, reliable to base decisions on technologies, okay, whether that's activated carbon, whether that's a reverse osmosis filter, whether that's a combination of reverse osmosis and activated carbon. And once we have digested the data that came with the report, because we have a number of samples that were run through pretty standard laboratory methods of, as Paul Hoff from the Pollution Control Agency mentioned, spiked water. We mimicked the water chemistry of your communities directly. We mimicked it in terms of pH, in terms of all the other chemistry factors that would be found in the water in these communities,
mm-hmm.
and then we put the chemicals in so that we could evaluate the effectiveness of treatment. Once we look at that data and have it ready to report, we will release it to the public, and we will give the public the advice that we believe is representative of that sampling method. The reason we are going the second step is to go directly into the communities that are affected and say, simply because it will add to our understanding and confirm, we believe, the results of the bench tests that were done, and to add public confidence to that information. So it would be likely that a consumer could act on this study that's coming out very soon, and it would be representative of treatment methodologies that could be employed in the home and have a likelihood of success. We would be very surprised that the confirmatory testing that we do in the community's water systems would lead us to any different conclusion than that.
Oops, I'm slow. Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Go ahead. So why are we doing the second phase? I mean, it's because this is why I sponsored this bill, was to get the information out to the public, and so now it's sort of like, well, here's the report, but hold on, we just want to confirm it. I'm kind of confused as to why we're doing this second part then, or why we're releasing the information. And I know that there's a sense of urgency also. So I just want to be sure that we're very clear that later on, in May, we might have a different finding, or this filter is actually a little bit better, but too bad you bought this one, I guess.
Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman, understand your concern, and the reasoning is because it adds to the... It goes beyond the level of what typical industry methods are. Typically, the Underwriters Laboratory or the Water Quality Association or any national organization that tests devices is going to do what has been done in the first phase of this study. They're going to develop a sampling protocol and test the results of their devices. We felt it important because of the level of concern and the future potential for investment in homeowners and by the state, possibly, in terms of future treatment needs, to look specifically in these communities. And I think that's it's unlikely to lead to a different recommendation to a homeowner, but it does add to the level of understanding and knowledge that says, yes, in fact, we did sample it in this setting, and now we know. The vast majority of the money, though, is being spent on the phase one. Very little of the money will actually be spent in phase two. So we have, it's not like it was 50-50, it was more closer to 80-20, I would say. But again, the vast majority of the cost of that project are in the laboratory sampling costs. And our public health lab has been running the results and very consistent methodologies, and the results, the clarity of the results have been very good. So we're optimistic that we'll be able to give consumers credible and long-lasting advice.
Thank you.
Representative Wallace. Mr. Chair, Mr. Stein, part of what we do here at the legislature is rumor control, but there's a rumor that the filters aren't breaking down the PFBAs and they're having troubles with them. Is that being part of what you're testing maybe out in these communities? And as the PFBAs, especially maybe in these sort of charcoal-type filters, they're having trouble with them processing the PFBAs? Have you found any research on that, or is that happening in your testing? Are you not allowed to let us know yet, or...?
There is data that will come out in our studies about how PFBA is handled by the various treatment methodologies. I can tell you that it is true that the treatment methodology is inactivated carbon has limits on its effect on removal of PFBA.
Mm-hmm. And, Madam Chair, and yeah, I just hope that's very clear to the public, because you would hate to see, especially down in Representative McNamara's area where there's the active PFBA, you want to make sure people have a filter that can work on PFBAs. And I, with the public, it's hard for us to know how it's going to be presented, but I hope that is crystal clear.
We will do our best to make that obvious to consumers, because that's part of our intent, is to provide them with the best advice. Representative Bigham knows that she has a constituent that was very concerned, and then this homeowner is a young mom who does daycare and wanted to know what they're considering making changes in their in their point of use filter system in their home. Mm-hmm. She's very interested in what our advice will be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not abstract to us. We know and we talk to those homeowners directly about what decisions they should consider and what information the studies will help them make. We will work individually with people. That's our business, is to help them understand what the health-based reasoning behind our study results will be, and I think that we'll be in a good position to give specific answers.
Representative Bingham.
Representative Flower, what I always do is I just give him Director Stein's direct line. So that he can explain to them why the delays and why, you know, what the process is more than I can.
Good
and it seems to work.
And maybe even seeing at the process.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
No,
I'd appreciate it if you didn't.
Director Stein, and I do want to get just very briefly back to that, and Dr. Hummel, we got off on a tangent, but since we are here, and this was important too, it was on the schedule as well, but the time was running out. Did I hear you just say that, and we won't start more rumors, but that, because initially when this first occurred, we thought that carbon activated would be effective probably.
Yes.
In fact, large carbon activated, I believe, is what we have in Oakdale, right?
Yes.
Okay, so under various conditions, and I heard a hint of maybe not so much and not as well as we might have liked.
Yes.
In your remarks just now. Is that correct?
That is
okay.
Partially correct.
That
I would also say, though, that it's partially the life expectancy
right.
of the filter
right.
itself. They do, activated carbon does reduce concentrations of PFDA. However, there are some things we're learning through the study that will help us give better advice about activated carbon treatment.
And actually, we did anticipate that. I mean, we did know that with PFDAs versus the longer chain chemicals, that it would be a much shorter life for any kind of filter, whether it was the large scale or the home filters with activated carbon. Since we are here, though, the other question that the constituent had wrote in about was that what we had thought we understood when you last talked about the filter study is that in this spiked water that you'd be doing fairly large doses of the chemicals, and the quite well-educated constituent in this area wrote in that it was his understanding that activated carbon often did not filter as well at lower levels of the chemicals than it did at higher levels, and that actually reduced the effectiveness of filtration, and therefore is concerned that your study may have been only doing the high doses. And can you confirm yes or no whether, in fact, it was only high doses, or did you do experimentation?
That's a good question, and I don't know the answer directly,
briefly.
So I'm asking Jim Kelly, who has helped with this project, step up here, so he may have a better answer to that question.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chairman, I'm Jim Kelly. I've been involved with some of the perfluorochemical issues and some of the testing in the filters since this project started. The question is point was a good one, and it could be true for certain contaminants. However, it hasn't been our experience with the PFCs, where the studies that we've done so far have been conducted at higher levels than we tend to see in the environment today. And that's the standard protocol. It's a national protocol for testing these filters. But the testing we've done with various types of carbon filtration at lower levels that we found in the communities, and granted it's been limited, it's still shown that they've been effective even at lower concentrations. And we're fairly confident that as we move to the next phase where we're going out in the communities, and that's really one of the reasons to do it too, is to test it in the more real-world conditions that we're thinking these filters are going to be used in, we're fairly confident we're going to continue to see that the filters are effective even at lower concentrations that we see in the various water supplies where we think they're going to be used.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Director Stein and Dr. Gayden. And Dr. Blutenhoff and or Dr. Zobel, if you would want to make a few, we might give you the last word here today, other than working group members, since we're running long, to any final response.
I know it's getting late, so this Madam Chair will be just real quick. I would just like to endorse something Representative Lugini suggested earlier. The University of Minnesota Medical School has a well-known endocrinology department. I don't know who is there now, but they've got certainly experts in thyroid disease. In addition, of course, the public health school, the University of Minnesota, has researchers in toxicology, and of course, Mayo Clinic is the third institution in our state that has a lot of expertise in this area, and we would certainly be in a lot of agreement with consulting with those with the individuals there that you would wish to. And
I just have one brief comment, and that is that, Madam Chair, that we have enjoyed, I think, a very good, close, cooperative working relationship with the MDH staff. We're going to continue to maintain that and do the best we can to get the most robust scientific HPV value for PFDA that we can. So, and I think if we have any minor disagreements on things, we'll certainly find ways of getting those resolved. And I think Larry suggested one possible one. So, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your presentation. And in closing, I just want to say, moving towards bringing it together as we did today, pieces of this information in terms of the 3M work have come to me over the last many months, and I was concerned that not all legislators were hearing it, and wanted to make sure we gave them an opportunity to discuss their research firsthand from the 90-day study and other efforts that they've been involved in, as well as hearing from the department so we could hear all aspects of the discussion and so a larger group could be exposed to that. So speaking of exposures. So thank you very much for all of your patience today, working group members, Senator Saltzman, Wagenius, other representatives that joined us, all of you in the audience, and 3M particularly for bringing out all your scientists today and presenting to us. We appreciate your time. Thank you so much.